Do this?
Yep.
She's waiting to do that forever.
Okay, so as everybody knows, my first time sharing this, so bear with me, okay? And I will be prodded along. We have a long agenda today, and so we want to stay on point. So with that, let's start with the regular and supplemental meeting, all to order, supplementing meeting for you guys. So before I start with the moment of silence, I'd like to send a particular tribute to Shad Rowe, who passed away last week, and he was one of the first directors, one of the first directors when in September of 2017. He was a mentor of mine. He was definitely tough, and he was a smart guy. And so to that, I want to just make a mention to that. Also on the list of past police and fire is Jerry Rhodes. Now, while all of our members are special, Jerry approached me my first day on the board to tell me to thank me for my service, to give me words of encouragement and said it's not going to be easy, and to say to always keep in mind that the people who have earned and deserve this pension is really the true sponsors. So I just want to also just give him a little attention as well. But with that said, I would like us all to bow our heads for a moment of silence. Okay. Now, I guess the next motion is going to be the approval of the minutes. So a motion to approve the minutes. And let's do both regular meeting, regular public meeting of October 10, 2024, and regular meeting of October 10, 2024.
Motion to approve the minutes.
Second. Right.
Take a vote.
So we need to go for comment?
Got a second. You still have to hold
it.
Sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None.
All opposed? Okay. So the first thing on the item, on the briefing item, is the public comment. So we do have a gallery here, and we also have people online. So if anybody wants to say anything, I guess this is the opportunity in which you can say it.
If you're online, press 5-star on the
sir.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. My name is Dave Kelly, and I want to thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. I'm here to commend the portfolio review of performance improvement efforts that Dallas Fire and Police Pension Fund trustees and staff have engaged in. Pension Fund is a tangible guarantee of compact public servants and those they serve. We teach our children, protect our homes, preserve our peace of body, mind, and spirit, and in the end of your service, we honor that by ensuring our country. Our town was quite secured by a full pension credit for citizens of Dallas, the government, and the fund invested through the pension funds and security of Dallas. A sacred promise. I know this because I had the privilege of serving as a trustee, chairman of the Teachers Retirement Trust. As a member of the investment committee of Dallas Children's Hospital in Dallas as well, I'm also a real estate private equity investor at Silicon Woods, Pesco, TPW, and all that has to do with funds. This experience has taught me that being a fiduciary is hard. Protecting and growing assets is not a straight upward path. There are moments of economic disruption. There are moments of poor investment performance. There are moments of just mistakes that are made with good intent. In my experience, success that actually secures those assets comes from the willingness to investigate performance issues, to accept the truth when you find it, and having the will to take action to improve. And so toward that end, I commend the decision to engage toward Wiley, Commerce Street Capital, and to assist in this process. I served with Gloria as a member of TRF. He was on our investment committee, and he was instrumental in the changes and improvements that allowed us to increase the size of the pension fund while also using benefits to our retirees. And so with that, given that the pension fund is a guarantee of this is promised. I commend the decision to engage more widely and commit to share the responsibility for it as well. I thank you for this decision. I thank you for your role in stewarding our promise to our public workers and servants. And I thank you for the moment to speak to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the galley would like to speak? Okay. What about star five, if you want to speak online?
No, I didn't see anything.
Nothing? Okay. So I guess we move forward for the 2023 financial audit. Brenda?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We have with us this morning Jody Hillebrand. She is a partner, or I guess principal is the new terminology that she's using, with BDO, who performed our audit. And she's going to take a few minutes to share with you some information about the audit. Jody?
Thank you, Brenda. I'm not going to go through the actual financial statements themselves. There were no adjustments made to the financials based on the information that you've already reviewed related to December of 2023. So walking through, you've already done so. We met with the audit committee before this to go over the conduct of the audit letter in detail. So I'm just going to kind of go through some of the highlights. We've substantially completed our audit. We were waiting on the actuarial report in this meeting before we finally issued. We expect to issue that in the next day or two. As part of the audit, we look at the quality of your financial reporting. We look at internal controls. If we find any issues there, we are required to communicate those to you. We did not find any material weaknesses in internal control that would indicate to us that there's a problem in the fund and the financial statements might not be material. We looked at significant areas focusing on reporting, alternative investments, and your actuarial evaluations where most of our audit time was spent. We did not identify any adjustments related to those areas or any areas for improvement. We did not identify any corrected or uncorrected misstatements. That just means that the financial statements and underlying data as given to us was deemed accurate based on our procedures that we performed. Everything that we asked for was freely given. Management cooperated 100%. There were no discussions with other firms, that kind of thing, and we were able to complete the audit. And then the only change that was made to our audit plan from initial to final issuance is we getting the actuarial report to the incorporation of the changes from August.
Any questions? Okay. No questions? All right. Let's move on.
We need to motion to approve the issuance of the audit report.
Okay. I'm going to motion to approve the issuance of the audit report.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Aye. All opposed? Okay. Motion is okay, so next item is a report on the audit committee, and I think Nick, Matt, and Tony were in the audit committee earlier, and if they have any comments with the audit committee, that they share.
Yeah, Matt's going to speak for us since I'm on the phone.
Sure, when asked point blank about best practices, anything being done at the highest level, there's been recommendations on how to improve our reporting, conduct of the staff, really with a clean bill of health all the way around. Negative report.
No one's bothered.
Someone else? Tony?
Tony wasn't there.
Okay, Tony wasn't there. Okay, great. Okay, there's no motion necessary for that. So the next item is a Commerce Street report for the City of Dallas. So in with this, I'm going to hand it over to Tom.
Can I make a quick
introduction
first? Okay, I just have, first I'd like to invite Mr. Wiley and your team to come up to the table.
Sure.
Thank you. So just logistically speaking, they are going to speak about their report, their last report that they gave to the council. Other than that, we may have an opportunity to know. Tom is going to be sharing this kind of part of the meeting. So take it away.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome everybody.
I'm sorry. Okay. There's one, before you start, I think Kelly wants to say
just
a couple of things.
So, yes, I'm sorry. Wanted to just remind everybody why we're having this item. And first of all, I did want to thank Dory and your team for being here today. We really appreciate that you're here. And the reason that we are having this agenda item today is, as we're all aware, the city of Dallas did an RFP and hired Commerce Street to do a scope of work, which I'm sure they'll cover in their presentation, so I'm not going to go over that. Commerce Street did an initial presentation to the City Council, which was really done without conversation with us, and some of those information from there was taken out of context or we felt was misinformation, and it caused a lot of problems for us, frankly. So what we wanted to do, we knew there was a final report coming along, so we wanted to make sure that the next report had our input and we could get the best quality report that we felt good about. And we wanted to be able to participate. So in doing that, we had a conversation with the board. And the board asked that we participate with Commerce Street. So they got the information they need and we answer their questions and help them with anything that they needed, which we did do. And that once they presented their report to the city council, then they would come here and present the same report. And that's why you're hearing this now. They were at the city council a few months ago, but because of scheduling issues, we're a little bit delayed in this report. So with that, as Tina said, Tom's really going to spearhead this item. We have an hour scheduled, but Tom will give some introductions as well. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. First of all, welcome to everybody. I appreciate everybody's time and being here. Just a few words before turning the platform over to Dory Wiley and his associates. We've all had a chance to read over the Commerce Street report. This is the one that's as of August 8, 2024. See the transcript, presentation to the City Council. In the interest of our fiduciary obligation to our constituents and good governance, we have a responsibility, all of us, to make a thoughtful and prudent decision, all things considered. Accordingly, the imperative to have information that is accurate, to ensure that any conclusions made are based on fact rather than misplaced interpretation, is crucial. For the time I've been involved with the board, IAC, and staff, I believe this is true. Like a number of the folks in this room, you know, I bring state experience as well. I was the CIO at the Employees Retirement System in Texas. So I'm aware of teachers and so forth and the governance that goes with that process. The process with the board and the IAC and staff, this is something that we've all been involved with and some that aren't here since 2017 when the event took place. I believe we all have the same goal of restoring the Dallas Peace and Fire to a sound footing. The plan, as we all know, has gone through some challenging times. Aside from a pandemic, almost complete change in board. In fact, about 73% of the current board has tenure starting in 2022. And the addition of tremendous financial and investment expertise, aided with the expertise of the Investment Advisory Committee. In addition, staff has evolved since this period that everything took place with three different CIOs and turnover since 2014. But has weathered this volatility by being focused on making positive, prudent changes as they've constructed the portfolio for future while taking advantage of investment opportunities short term. This is important because not all asset classes, as most of you know, are not created equal, whether it's private equity, equities, infrastructure, real estate, you name it. They're all on a risk-adjusted basis, which we have to be aware of as we go forward. So with that, as a background and perspective, I'd like to turn the program over to Dory. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here today. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I need to apologize in advance. I don't hear very well, and the acoustics in here are a little tricky for my hearing aids. So I may have to get you to repeat a question or something like that. I think Kelly's already familiar with that because her voice is right in that octave where I don't hear very well. So anyway, thank you for having us here today. I'd like to introduce my colleagues. I got Matt Den Blinker here, Duke Mathaler, and Grant Glover. Grant's a superstar analyst that we have, and Duke and Matt both have come with many years of direct pension fund experience and pension fund consulting experience. You can look up their resumes later. I know there's been some discussion in this room about whether we're qualified or not. We can spend the next hour debating that subject. It really doesn't matter. We want to focus on the same message that you do, Mr. Hall, which is how do we do better for police and police officers and firefighters, help their pension, help them get a COLA. I mean, they haven't had one in 7 years. I think if we can all start with that same goal and move forward, that'd be great. The relationship between the city and this pension fund has been strained for many years. I've seen it from afar. I've been watching it for 20 years. This is why we got involved. I'm tired of watching it. I wanted to improve as a citizen. I was asked by one of the city council people, why are you doing this? What are you motivated for? Well, certainly not the $50,000 contract. We can make that in a trade. The goal is to help in any way we can. And we think it starts with communication. There's been a communication breakdown. There's been a recent lawsuit to help further break down that communication. All of a sudden, we find ourselves in a position where we're almost maybe the only link to that communication now. Here we are today. We've been wanting to meet with you. I apologize for not being able to meet with you in September. Not sure what was communicated to you, but I had a trip to Scotland and a funeral I had to deal with, which I could not move. I provided 8 different dates, and this is the earliest one that we could coordinate. So I hope you would back that up, because I think there's been some rumors that we were not willing to meet with you guys, and I think if you study the record, that's not the case. Same thing with input. We've tried to get as much input as we can. The city did not give us a lot of time on this. It was basically almost 2 weeks before, a couple of weeks before we were hired, before we they were wanting a report. It happened very quick. Many kudos to the staff for juggling their schedules around to meet with us and go over every report that we ever went through in public. We've made many deletions, many additions. There were probably some things in there they didn't want us to have go out, but they did see everything. They did have a lot of input in it. And in many ways, it was helpful. I found that while the early meetings were contentious, the more we met, the better they became. Our goal is really not to meet in public. We didn't want to meet in public with the city either. We think our best work could be done in private, working with you individually, reaching out to you as board members one-on-one, and taking meetings. I found out, Tom, you were willing to meet. I apologize for not pursuing that. There were a few board members I tried to meet with, and they stiff-armed me. Met with Nick, had a good meeting. I think in the future, an open dialogue would be good. I think the best thing that could come out of this meeting is that that is our number one goal. Communication, olive branch, peace with the city. We're all in this together. This is the best city and the best state and the best country in the world. We shouldn't be broke because of a pension fund. It's not your fault. No one said it was your fault. We never said it was your fault. You inherited a really bad hand. And we understand everyone has been working very hard to deal with. And we've been very consistent in that message. Extremely consistent. No matter what you've heard, that is the message. We understand that. The real question is, where do we go going forward? What is the plan? We were first approached by the city and some representatives, hey, we're going to have to raise taxes. We're going to have to sell assets, come up with $10 or $20 million or $30 or $40 here and there. And how do we respond to this? What if we have to do a pension obligation bond? what do you think? Well, I don't know. We'd have to look at it. Well, we looked at it and we said, well, you're obviously going to be faced with the press and the public. I don't know what that is. It was a random Skype call into my hearing aids. It was very loud. Anyway, we're accountable as a city to the citizens and the press and the public for making sure that if we do these things, that the funds are going to be put into the pension plan and they'll be good stewards.
You took Paul to school.
What was that? Oh, go ahead. And the funds will be invested in a prudent, you know, matter. This also includes ERF, by the way. The question was about both funds. And in many ways, it was kind of a perfunctory exercise, right? Hey, we got to do this. We got to make sure that we can go to the public. And we hired an independent group that said, hey, yeah, that's okay to do this, and we're helping out. So in the process of meeting with ERF, they were very friendly with us. No one likes to be second-guessed, I guess, if you could say, right? Hey, you could have done this, could have done that. It's easy to do that. It's Monday morning quarterbacking. But they took it all in stride, and they've been very good to work with. At ERF, they're performing average to slightly below average, depending on how you're looking at it. Having said that, they're funding ratio is a little higher than here, but still not where it needs to be. And over a 10-year period, they could do 1% to 2% better, we think. That'll be their plan, not ours. But we had some ideas suggested to them, and some of them liked the ideas. We'll see what happens. But 1% to 2% on a $3.5 billion plan is $350 million to $700 million over 10 years, which is a whole lot of money and very difficult for the city to come up with. And I think over here, what we want to do is really accomplish the same thing. We know what you've been through. We understand that. Is there a way to define risk, reduce risk, increase returns so that the city doesn't have to write as big a check? Okay? If you've got those plans, that's great. We've not been privy to them. Okay? We've not been privy to them. What happens if you get a big check from the city? Where is it going? Well, what are we doing to address some of these risk issues that we talked about? So we'll go through some of these, but at the end of the day, no matter what we say, going through this program, we're going to end with the same message, which is we are an olive branch from the city. We are trying to work with you to improve benefits and get a COLA for these guys as soon as possible. And I think you have the same goal, okay? Now, you may think our ideas or our discussions or bunk, or not meaningful or whatever, but the intent is pure. And if we can start with intent, then we have a relationship. Then we have a relationship, and the intent is pure. So we've been met with a lot of defensiveness. We're not sure why that exists, but if we can start with the intentions, I think we'll make some ground. So having said that, I know you have a lot of questions. We'll hit a few slides. First of all, in the opening, do you have any more comments, Duke or Matt or anything, anyone on the opening?
No, I think we're all for the same purpose.
Okay, all here for the same purpose. All right, a few points that I think we can all agree on. And by the way, this is the presentation from the 8th. We did some revisions on it, and we sent it over last night. I apologize. It didn't get through our compliance fast enough. The revisions weren't big material, and we understand that that made you uncomfortable, and I apologize for that. We didn't want to make you uncomfortable, so we're going to go over the other one. That's just fine. And if you'd like to go over the new slides later, we can do that.
Yeah, we prefer to stick to the basics, and we can always build on the additional material at some future point in time.
I couldn't understand. We'll
do additional material in future period of time.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. A few points we think we can all agree on. We're underfunded. The city of Dallas is going to have to write a check. The public, city officials, beneficiaries, and all stakeholders want assurance that the plan has optimal performance, right? Optimal. Now, I'm going to assume, you know, a lot of you are investment people. A lot of you have investing backgrounds. You're dealing with this. Please don't fight me on specifics when I talk about performance or optimal. It's all risk adjusted. It's all taken into account the risk and reward of each asset. Otherwise, we'll spend a lot of time here on an academic exercise arguing about things that we all probably agree on, which is sort of a moot point. Legacy assets continue to contribute to the underperformance. Performance over time should net of fees and investment costs exceed benchmarks and median of plan peers. Group performance combined with increased contributions should help get to this goal that we're talking about on a COLA and all of that. So I'm going to go to the next page. Initial observations. Improved risk-adjusted returns are needed to lower city contributions. Dallas Police and Fire's underperformance peers both nationally and the state of Texas over 5 to 10 year time periods. We all know why. You know, so there's not a lot of debate. There's a lot of legacy asset problems. Dallas Police and Fire has struggled with legacy assets the last 10 years and have made improvements with them, getting rid of quite a bit of them, by the way, over the last 7 years. And what you're left with is what I call the worst of the worst. So I understand that's the most difficult to deal with. We do think that there's a way to target reducing volatility risk and improving risk-adjusted allocation, as well as private equity manager selection. Obviously, you haven't been picking them, so I understand that. You haven't been investing. That's one of the issues we're going to discuss about. You haven't been in private markets for the last 7 years. And there's a need to create an improved private market strategy for you guys going forward. I think you hired Auburn to do that almost 2 years ago. And so while I've not seen that or the results of that, I'm sure there is a lot of progress being made. We're just not privy to it. And I think it's really
clear that was just within the last 12 months Auburn's been hired.
Yeah, but my memory, and it could be wrong, was it was done in the fall of 23.
A year.
Okay. All right, so 1 year. My bad. Okay. Let's see. The goal is to, on ours, for the fund, to be less risky than it is now. So we'll talk about some of the risk in it. We want to increase returns and performance. Obviously, those are risk adjusted. While also considering, the growth in liabilities and your safety reserve. We're cognizant of all of that. I'm going to skip some more pages. This page, we gave you a new page that I think is a little easier. This one's kind of busy, but the basic point is the market value of assets on 6/30/2017, this is what a new one we put in there, Ryan, was $2.12 billion. Over the last 7 years, that's dropped down to $1.98 billion, while liabilities have gone from $4.4 billion up to $5.7 billion. Funding ratio has gone from almost 49% to 34%. None of that is news to you. We're just saying that the fund is stability is decreasing, and the sense of urgency is there, as you know. It's an observation or pointing out the obvious to you guys. This is a slide that we spent quite a bit of time on with the city and others, and it's a philosophy slide. Let me go back. Let's see. Where is it?
It's a new slide.
Where's this slide?
It's a new slide.
Where is it?
It's not in this.
It's not in this presentation? Well, the slide I wanted to talk about anyway. Let's see.
Again, we're keeping to the basic representation that you sent over that we're all working with.
That's right. The slide I wanted to talk about basically is a premise that I think most of you in investing would be familiar with, is if you focus on stocks and bonds, the difference between top quartile performance and bottom quartile performance is very thin, right? and it's the argument for passive investing. Makita's made a lot of recommendation for you guys to focus on or improve or increase some passive exposures. We're big advocates of that. You know, if you find managers that outperform and give alpha over 5 to 10 year periods, we're all for it. We do that internally, but we also do lots of passive investing, and we think that's a good strategy. The point being is, where do you spend your time, right? And if you spend your time, I think you guys have, and pardon my assumption, I'm assuming you spend a lot of your time on that and dealing with problem assets. There has not been any investing in private assets over the last 7 years, and that's where the alpha is. The difference between top quartile performing private equity and bottom quartile performing private equity is about 2,100 basis points, and there are similar type numbers in the other areas of private markets. So we're big advocates of trying to get exposure in some of those areas, but you have to be very careful about how you do it. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. Well, let's just talk about it now. You know, direct investing, which is what Tedeman and the previous group did, they had a lot of problems with, you know, that would be like the museum tower. That's the most risk, less risk in a fund, less risk in a fund of funds or secondaries or interval funds, something like that. The goal is, how do I get that exposure, that passive exposure, so I can get those returns injected and get the diversification into the portfolio? And that's what we see is lacking. You know it's lacking, and that's because you've been dealing with problem assets. I'm not going to spend time on that one. We talked with Nick and the group about exposure to foreign markets and versus domestic. You guys have a large allocation versus the index, whether it be ACWI or ACWI IMI, they track very similar. It doesn't matter. The performance between the two is not much, and I understand that you have a different benchmark, which is IMI, but it's the same result, the same discussion. And Nick acquiesced several times, I think even in a board meeting and with us individually, that, yeah, we probably have too big of exposure to foreign markets. Foreign markets, as you know, have the same volatility, but lower performance over the last 20 to 30 years.
Very good, about 5 minutes.
Okay. Let's hit a couple other things. This slide, right here, this is a philosophy slide for us on asset allocation. If you look at your asset allocation right now, you are, you've got an allocation to private equity, and you got an allocation to other alts or real estate and whatnot. Our point is you really don't. You really don't. And here's why we say that. The analogy comparison I would give would be to banking. If we have loans that have problems, they become non-performing assets, and we move them out of the allocation so that we actually get an allocation back into loans, the non-performing assets. You have that. Most of your privates are non-performing assets, so you really don't have a private asset allocation or private markets allocation, and you're not getting a return from it. And so our point would be as well, you haven't been in that for 7 years. If you start doing LP investing now, you're going to have J curves. You don't have another 7 years to wait to get the returns. You need current pay, low risk private assets. How do you get that? Concentrated fund of funds, other fund of funds, interval funds, secondary funds, private credit, current pay, all of that kind of stuff we think could have been very additive for you and added for you going forward. And it would help this problem. This problem is this is kind of a simple thing we use in money management. These weightings of our top quartile allocations. Okay, and we all know your CFAs and CAIAs and whatnot. You know, 90% of asset return, portfolio returns are asset allocation, the other 10% is management selection. If we can get the weighting right, which here it is as a blueprint, And I know it's a point in time, and I know it's looking backward. Okay, that's all understood. We can debate the merits of that. But when you look at it, you guys review that every 3 years, right? And Makita's on record in your report saying, hey, you could do it every 3 to 5 years, right? If this is at a point in time, we know this is good for at least 2 to 4 years, right? The point is, we don't even have anything close to this. And if you just do that and get index or asset exposure, okay, I understand that some indices are not investable, but you can mimic them, right? So it's difficult to get hedge funds or private equity or whatnot, but you indices, but you can get the exposure. That's the point. And you don't have that exposure. You don't have any of that exposure. All you have are non-performing assets. It may be 5% exposure. You know, you got an ag fund that's done pretty good. So what we would say is we would like to sit down and work with you behind the scenes, not necessarily in public forum. We're not trying to fight with you and go, hey, where are we wrong in this? Or what's the plan going forward? Or what are you doing with Allborn? Because you need a more diversified, less risky exposure rather than just stocks and bonds and non-performing assets. There's too much volatility, and we all know the valuation issues in the stock market today. And we have another 40% drop like we had in the year 2000 or 2008. How are you going to recover from that?
Hey, Dory, this is Nick. I have a question for you, given what you're saying. For that, to implement what you're saying right there, how would you fund that? You see our portfolio. Would you reduce our safety reserve? Would you sell bonds? Would you sell public equities? All three things have been producing positive returns. So to implement your plan, how would you fund that?
Yes, I would take less risk. Let's look at this one, this slide. Look at 29 and see the public equity at 51%. If we look at top quartile pensions and, you know, we could reduce that. I would take some out of public equity. I might take some out of fixed income. I might increase cash. And then I would, again, I'm looking for private market assets that have either a liquidity feature, also get me the correlation, current pay, and less risk. We don't have the ability to try to reach for that top quartile private markets, right? So picking venture, picking energy, picking direct assets, all that stuff's off the table. We got to do something plain and boring and low risk to get us that. And you can do that by taking it out of some of these other allocations. And when you do that, you have less risk in the public markets, which is the most volatile of all the assets.
And just a quick comment in terms of privates. One, you've got two things to contend with, and there's a time and a place for alternatives. We have a lot of liquidity constraints right now, which is a given. But with privates, one, don't forget the fact that the reason they do so well is because they have so much leverage.
They have what?
Leverage.
They have a lot of leverage.
I understand. Yeah, I don't like leverage.
We don't either, especially when you're not getting compensated. The other is the illiquidity premium. And a lot of times you can take advantage of it, a lot of times you can't. So, yeah, it's easier said than done. There's a time and a place for every style. Private equity, as you know, is going through a lot of tumultuous times right now. A number of them are going to go bankrupt. A number of them are going to be turning their assets over to the banks. So, you know, there's a time and place for every asset class.
And I agree with all of that, that there are risks in private equity and leverage and stuff. But the point is diversification, and we've got none. We've got no exposure to it because the others are not performing. Even Ryan's advocated, hey, maybe we ought to put this over in a separate bucket so it doesn't count. Even when you report DPFP X private markets, you're sort of de facto saying we have NPAs and they don't count. But when you do that and you look at DPFP X private markets is what? It's stocks and bonds. So all I'm advocating is diversification because I'm worried that a 70-30, which is essentially what you have now, is more risky, and you've seen all the academia on that. That is more risky than a diversified portfolio. It's pretty simple.
Was there an analysis comparing systems in the same situations as DPFP, meaning these are all point in time, and it's well known that depending on your funded status, you're going to have a different allocation, right? And it's appropriate at different times. So pensions over time, depending on their funded status, adjust their overall allocation. What did the analysis show for plans that are in the same situation as DPFP that got to a funded status, how they move through their allocation? Because that is what we're facing.
And to your point, with another thing, I think it's also the benchmark. You're talking about benchmark and comparison.
No. Yeah, but it's not just that. It's that if you're comparing it to Austin Pension or ERF and they are 90% funded, their allocation is going to reflect their current reality. And so if they're a top performing allocation, but they're not in the same situation in their funded status, it's not apples to apples. The question is, what does someone do in our situation with our liquidity constraints, and what's a prudent portfolio in that situation? That analysis helps us move from where we are to where we want to be. And that's what I would want to see.
Sure. No, absolutely. Because it's sort of, if someone doesn't have problems, you're like, well, how do we compare to them? So it's really a step-by-step process. We know we want to get to top quartile, right? But how do we get there when we're in bottom quartile and we have all these problems? And so one example may be Houston MEPS. Houston MEPS had problems, and they changed everything. And when I was at TRS, before I got there, John Peavy was begged to come down there and be CIO because they have, guess what, a bunch of direct investment problems from the late 80s and early 90s. And so John Peavy, I'll bring him up because he's on the ERF board and he's been there for 15 years. The first thing he did is he hired a workout guy from a bank that did real estate to come work out all those problems. And it took him 3 years and they got through it. Then next they started doing, allocation to private assets. And
Correct.
Then they built up. And they at first they did boring stuff, right? We do boring stuff with very low risk to the bottom side because I have this top quartile, bottom quartile issue on private equity performance, and I don't want to miss. So you start with what? Fund of funds.
But do you know what the size of their allocation? Because there was a lot of stuff in the analysis that talked about.
Yes, we had it in the new slide, but we weren't allowed to use it. But we compared your allocation to bottom quartile funds, which would obviously
have
an issue.
I saw that. I think you're missing my point. You detailed out a pension plan that went through a 3-5 year process to work out their issues. My question is, at any snapshot point in time, what did their allocation look like? We're getting compared in the allocation that we have to bottom performing funds, but it's not a motion capture of how do you go step by step. That's the challenge for Ryan and the team. How do you go step by step and what's prudent at each step? So the 5% that we have, I posit to you that it's a snapshot point in time. It's not inclusive of any details of how we like to get there. And you pointed out that transparency and communication is the way forward. I truly believe that. So when you start out with the prudent allocation, considering where we are at 5%, knowing that then to move that allocation requires the IAC and the board to come together, it provides a foundation as we move forward for greater transparency and communication. So we're starting at the 5, snapshot in time, liquidity issues, legacy issues. Once we want to move to 10 and we want to figure out how we do that, that's going to require a discussion. Everybody gets the chance to communicate. So I posit to you, what you're looking at is the start of a journey. It doesn't disagree with what you said, but to compare it to the end of someone's journey is a bit of out of context and makes it really hard to understand how their end allocation serves us in our path forward.
Well, obviously, you know, that's up to you guys. How do you get to that end point? How do you get there? Do we have ideas and help for that? Absolutely, we do. You may want them, you may not want them. You got a staff, you got expertise, you have consultants. If we're part of that discussion, we'd love to be part of a prudent discussion for that because we definitely think we have something to bring to the table on it. Do we have all the answers? No. Is every situation different? Absolutely. Are we privy to all those issues? No, we're not. We're very early in the process. All we can say is we do think there's a path there. We do think there's a way to reduce risk, and it's sort of like getting on a roadmap and going somewhere. You know, we may hit some road construction sites, had to change the direction, but at the end of the day, we still know where we're going.
Can I ask a clarifying question? You mentioned risk a few times. Is that defined as mark-to-market kind of volatility? Is that the sole way that we're discussing risk?
It's taking risk that we're talking about primarily volatility risk.
Because I come from
the banking world as well, and so loss of money is a big deal to me. I think this fund would know that better than anyone. So risk encompasses a lot of things. So I'm generalizing when I say risk, and not meant to be nitpicked about it, but if we measure risk through volatility, right, which is just one way to do it as part of it, then a lot of what we're talking about is, yes, how do we reduce that volatility?
Yeah, and I don't disagree. I've said it many times that I think risk is multi-layered. Sometimes it's mark-to-market, and there's some benefits in using privates in a portfolio to take advantage of that disparity. But there is another consideration that we have, right? If we're thinking about plan participants, ultimately the loss of capital is your true risk. So while going into private markets may reduce volatility on the surface and make maybe our quarterly reporting look a little cleaner or a little better, you still, as fiduciaries, want to take into account that the true risk, the risk that this thing doesn't work out, is still there. And in that respect, you know, private markets has as much risk, if not more, than some of the asset classes that are marked to market. So I think
it depends on how you do it. We're fully 100%.
Yeah, so I think we're trying to balance out how much true exposure risk you're taking in the asset class versus how much mark-to-market risk. And that's the dance that we want to be conscious of, because at the end of the day, it could be held at cost for its full life. But if it goes to zero, the plan participants are the ones that
suffer. We understand market-to-market issues. We get all of that. We understand. And
cool.
It's hard to get all of that on one page, right? You'd write
Agreed. Six
pages of caveats for every comment you make.
Another thought in terms of foreign equities versus U.S. equities, and again, we want diversification, and there's a benefit to diversification longer term. That's really the only free lunch you get on Wall Street, bottom line. So looking at foreign equities, U.S. market has outperformed for a number of years now. It just seems that why ignore foreign equities as an area to invest and look at, especially given the changing world that we're definitely going to be facing over the next several years. Whether it's deglobalization, whether it's new ways of doing old business, you name it. But to say, well, okay, put all your money in the U.S. equities, that just seems irrational.
I don't think that's what was said. I think what was pointed out was that you have four global equity managers that make their tactical decisions. And even though they have different strategies, overall, when you break it down, their decisions collectively significantly overweighted the non-U.S. market to the U.S. market. A lot of it's driven by valuations, because non-U.S. markets are cheaper than U.S. markets, granted. But in looking at it and thinking about it, and with ACWI IMI, if that's your benchmark, and seconding what some of the things Makiya has said, and looking at the performance of the global managers on a 1, 3, 5-year basis, you know, it may make some sense to have some money in a ACWI IMI type strategy that then is not taking a bet either for or against the U.S. It's not overweighting, and then you have some allocation where you will have some specific allocations on a regional basis, and then you have somebody that's going to be your tactical asset allocator overall. There's different ways to do this, as you well know, and your lengthy experience. And so in terms of looking at it, it's just an observation that, and I think even Nick talked about this, is that the decisions that were made by the managers, you know, all with good intentions, unfortunately were not beneficial to the fund as if you had been basically much closer to the benchmark, right? And so in terms of thinking about it and talking about risk control and everything, one of the things that you're sitting there and you think about as an investor is, how are we going to somewhat control our risk versus what we see are our particular benchmarks, which gets reported, you know, by Makita. So those are just the comments. We're not suggesting that you put it all into the U.S. I don't see that in any part of the presentations or reports. And I think that in terms of looking at it, just simply being a little bit closer to the benchmark is something that would, and in many ways, de-risk the portfolio from that perspective. That was the point of that slide.
Right there.
Very well put. You know, the goal at the end of the day is, you know, we can't control where the market goes, right? You hire people to come in with capital markets assumptions, do predictions, whatever. What do we know about that? You know, I get on Fox Business, I get on CNBC tomorrow, and I'm going to talk about the market. And all we know is Dory doesn't know, and neither does anyone else. All I know is if I'm running a pension fund or a portfolio, I need to beat my benchmark, and I need to beat my peers, or I got a problem. I got a problem. And that's what we want to help you do. That's what we want to help you do. So if you look at this page, the staff was very helpful in creating this page that we used. And just forget the 10-year a little bit. Focus on the 5-year. We want to help bring that up, both those numbers, the 5.2 and the 7.7. You know, they're closer to the bottom quartile, and we want to get them up. And I know you do too. And I think we can help you do that. Ex private markets, which are basically non-performing assets, or with them. And I think we've got some ideas to even help you on disposition of some of those assets. None of them may be any good. Don't know. Maybe Ryan's tried everything in the world. I can sense his frustration from here. And I get that. And it's not to second guess you. It's not to second guess you. But in working with 1,600 bank clients in the world, in the U.S., the biggest issue we have in a levered institution is what? Non-performing assets. We have to get rid of them. We have to get rid of them in a hurry. And we may have an idea or two. And if it's not worth anything, it's not worth anything. You had a question.
Well, by the way, just for the record as well, if we were fortunate enough to get that large check you talked about at the very beginning, we definitely have a plan for deployment and capital.
Would love to see it. Okay. Would love to see it. Haven't seen the plan, but would love to see it because, as you can imagine, the city's accountable to its citizens, the taxpayers, and the police officers and the firefighters, and saying, hey, they've got a great plan. Let's get behind it, and everybody hold hands. You know, we all have constituents. One of the things that when we hired Britt Harris, a teacher retirement system, we were making massive changes to the asset allocation. And to his credit on this, he said, we're going to start a roadshow. We're all going to join hands. And we're going to go to all these different school districts and cities and towns and hold all these presentations and go to the state legislature so they know exactly what we're doing and why. It was very much a PR campaign. It's a PR campaign. And, you know, through no fault of you guys, the previous regime, you know, we can do that. We'd love to work with you on that. Hey, we're all going to hold hands, and we're going to work with the press and everybody else, and we got a bright future ahead, and here's where we want to be in 5 years.
Well, I'd say that, yeah, I believe that we consider ourselves an open book. You know, we're available anytime, any place to, you know, to make things right and go forward and continue to build on what we have been building.
Could you also go
hey, Dory, one other question. When you first started talking to the city, I would think, given your experience and skills and everything, one of your first observations would be, why did you wait until 6 years of a 7-year clock when you knew very well 7 years ago these issues were there? Why didn't you engage me 6 or 7 years ago where I would have had time to actually help maybe implement some decisions versus being retained literally, you know, months before all these statutory considerations? Did you press the city on that, or did you struggle with that issue?
Hey, Nick, that is a 100% knock the ball out of the park, Mickey Mantle home run, okay? We agree with that. And if you go back to the August meeting with the city council, we brought this up. This is why you need to hire a consultant. None of this should be a surprise to them. You know, you've been very adamant for years. You know, Kelly, this is a problem. This is a problem. This is a problem. Everyone's been a problem. And some of the city get it. Some of them get it. It depends on what fire they're dealing with at the moment. They need somebody watching it all the time. One of the things that we uncovered in the process was that Wilshire, and I don't know if you've been able to look this up or not, but that Wilshire had terminated its relationship with the plan, correct?
No,
not correct.
That's not correct. We did look that up, and that is not correct.
What did you say? It's not correct. It looks it up. That's not correct.
Oh, it's not correct. All right, we'll try to confirm it through Wilshire. The story was is that Wilshire had terminated his relationship with the plan way before all you guys, and that would have been a red flag. So let's just use it as a hypothetical. That would have been a red flag for somebody working with you.
One minute, please. Josh, would you go ahead and comment, please?
I mean,
What we have in our files is that the board terminated Wilshire. So where the question to you is, where did you hear that Wilshire terminated its contract?
What did you say? Where did you hear that Wilshire terminated the contract?
Oh, I heard it from someone over at ERF. Yeah.
Okay.
Because, well, you know, they use Wilshire.
We don't deal with Wilshire. Moving on.
Yeah. So anyway, it could be incorrect. But the point being is a consultant could for the city can, A, monitor the reports, look at them. You guys provide great information to the city. The question is, are they staying up at night and reading it? Okay. I think they are right now, but I'm not sure they were before.
Or okay. You understand that these incorrect statements have damage to the city council. They certainly heard it. They responded to it. So I would just counsel you that.
Well, all of that was pre-2016.
I'm not talking about just that. I'm just talking about some of these statements that you throw out that are not.
And I will make sure and make amends to them. Okay? But I also want to make sure and throw this out there, too. Any incorrect statements about me personally or Commerce Street, they need to be make amended to. Let's work together, okay? And I apologize if that's an incorrect statement. I'll make sure that everyone I know on the city council hears about it, okay?
Okay.
But again, you can throw all that under the bus with the previous regime that put us in this spot to begin with.
Can we want to move forward.
Finish your point, Michael. So
I finished it. That you know, this kind of broad sweep in several areas as it relates to what we're trying to do here and the decisions that we've made related to private equity investments. I listened to the transcript. I read the transcript. I listened to your report, your presentation. And I think some of these kind of offhanded side comments were very damaging to the work that we are trying to do.
What are the other ones you'd like to address? I'm happy to do that. And if I'm wrong, I'm happy to eat crow.
That you know, we've been out of the market, the private equity market, for 7 years. And that
have y'all been in the private equity market?
Let me just finish. And that we don't know, you know, that we're just going to come in and invest in a bunch of private equity funds, and in 7 years, we're not going to know what's going on. I mean, we have some very bright, experienced people, not only on the IAC, but the trustees. And we understand that. We know that. I understand that you might not know that we know that, but it's very damaging to make a comment that, hey, to invest in private equity and you're not going to know what you're going to do for 7 years, we wouldn't do that. We understand secondaries. We understand fund to funds. We understand building a plan. We have hired Allborn to help us with that, knowing where we are and where we want to get to and the distributions that we have to make and everything else. So I would counsel you to be very careful in kind of the commentary you throw out, maybe as a sidebar or
Can I address that? First of all, I appreciate your comments and your intent, okay? I will endeavor to be more careful about what I say and more clear. I'm not known for being very clear on my speaking. I'm a better numbers guy than I am a speaker. Okay, I think what you interpreted is actually or misconstrued about what I said, and I'll take the blame for that for maybe not saying it correctly. But here's what I meant. First of all, I've been very clear about to the city that this is a very experienced, qualified board. Okay, and staff, they've been through a lot. What I said is if you start investing in private equity with J-curves, right? I say this all the time. No matter what I know your background in private equity, and I wanted to meet with you on this, and you stiff-armed me.
No,
right?
I didn't stiff-arm you. You
yes, met. You did. You said you would not meet with me.
I did.
Period.
Because you met with another trustee, and at the end of the meeting, you threatened to sue him.
No, I did that at the beginning of the meeting.
Okay, well, I mean...
I did it at the beginning of the meeting, and I had very good cause.
So I decided there was no
but
reason.
But that's from the libel comments he did in a public meeting, okay?
That's the reason why I chose not to meet with you, because you met with him.
Well, that's a shame. Nick met with me several times, and I didn't threaten to sue him, and I wouldn't have threatened anyone else. If you hadn't said anything libel about me, I don't know what you'd have to worry about. Okay? So let's focus. Am I incorrect?
No, I'm just correcting the record. Yeah, the reason no. why.
You know, it's a shame. So we had a misunderstanding. I think we ought to meet. I assume no one would meet with me, and I should have called Tom because he said he would have met with me.
Yep.
And if you don't want to meet, that's fine, but I'm happy to meet with you and discuss it.
I'm always
and
ready
I'm not to interested in suing anyone, to be honest with you. That's what I told Tony. I said, Tony, if this had been in private business, I would have. But this is not about us, Tony. This is about police officers, and it's about firemen, so we're going to skip that, okay? And that's why I didn't. I didn't threaten to sue him. I told him I wouldn't. Now, let's get back to the comment.
I just want to finish. You made a comment that the trustees, you wanted to meet with us, and we stiff-armed you. And that was not the case. I did not.
Did you not tell me you would not meet with me?
I told you that I did not want to meet with you.
Okay, exactly. Let's avoid the innuendos, and let's get to the basics of why we're here.
Can I address that private equity issue, though? The point on private equity, and I've said this about me and my expertise. Dory, go build me a top quartile private equity portfolio. Great. Give me $300 million. Check back with me in 7 years. Because I got to make J-curve investments. I got to see how they do. And then we're going to lose money for a while. And then we'll see how we're doing. That's what the comment means. It has nothing to do with someone's expertise. It has to do with the market and how you build the portfolio. But if you want some passive exposure and current returns and maybe some liquidity features, you can do that right away. That's the difference. And if I said that incorrectly and you took it as a personal insult, I apologize.
No, we agree. We agree. I think the intimation that you said a few times is that you'd like to help us, and you intimated that we didn't know some very foundational things about building a portfolio, right? And so I think... I said intimated. So I think what the pushback is that we do have the expertise to build a portfolio from here going forward to what we want to be. The expertise in how to build a pension portfolio, what allocation should look like, what J-curves mean, how to use interval funds if they're appropriate, how to use secondaries, primaries, directs, co-invest. It all sits at the board and on the IAC currently. We're grateful for your offer to partner with us. When you started getting into details of what that means, again, you intimated that we didn't have those expertise, and I think that that's where you're feeling the pushback. It's not to say you don't have those expertise, but I don't think it's lacking where we are, and we want to make sure that you're aware of that. That's it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, and let's clear the air right now. I respect every one of you, okay? And I'm not after anyone. We just want to work with you.
Yeah,
and if you got the impression that we thought less of your expertise, it's an incorrect one. I 100% promise you that. I know your resumes. I know your bios. And I know your background. Okay? And we all know this is really not that hard. It's just about getting the idea and breaking inertia and this, that, and the other and that kind of stuff. You might want to question how you got that impression that we thought less of you. If it's something we said, we apologize. If it's something that was conveyed to you, consider the message. And then let's just increase more dialogue between us. And I think we can break all that down.
Okay, yeah, and Dory, Dory, it's Dick. While we're clearing the air, I just think the other thing that I would ask for you to just acknowledge is that, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time. And so, you know, the imputation of goodwill was there and has always been there. In this assignment you did and in our prior dealings. But I think it would be naive on your part to not acknowledge that your good intentions were in many ways hijacked and twisted by other stakeholders in this process that in our minds commingle you with those you know thoughts. Like we've had city council people, you know, tell us that we just have to produce better returns, like that's an aha moment or something. And so, you know, in terms of this being practical and you actually helping us, we have to somehow deal with that issue because we feel like your work efforts have been repackaged, would be the kindest way to say it, by other stakeholders in ways that have been very negative towards the process. And by the way, I would love to have seen on paper your recommendation to the city about a realistic COLA. You mentioned that right from the get-go. If you said that to the city council people, I missed it because, man, we're on the same piece of paper.
You know, the COLA obviously is a statute issue, and this is beyond my scope, obviously, but it's just my opinion. But I do know the city was sincerely working on this stipend, and at least that was a way to kind of temporarily get around it until you could fix this legislature issue. And so I, for whatever reason, you know, the lawsuit happened, and all we know about lawsuits first year out of school is that's when communications break down, right? And that's unfortunate because I'd like to see the stipend happen. At least it's some kind of bridge, you know, until you can solve either the lawsuit and some of these other issues. So I would encourage you to, and again, it's beyond the scope of what I do, but work with your communications with the city to try to get that stipend regardless of what's going on.
Well, I mean, your words were COLA, not stipend. The magnitude is huge.
Will it get
and
COLA?
And
COLA
I would have and I would have thought because you mentioned your tasks included ERF. What we would love would be COLA parity with ERF, and I would have hoped that your work would have included querying the city on how much they're contributing that goes to that COLA, and perhaps a source of funding for our COLA could be COLA parity between the two plans. So, once again, you mentioned ERF, you mentioned COLA. Those would be reasonable things that we would want you to do in terms of two-way communication. I agree on communication, but it has to be two ways. So I would love for you to get back to us with how much the city's contributing that goes to the COLA and a recommendation of COLA parity between the two plans.
Now, point well taken, and I'm happy to do that. Again, it's beyond the scope of what we've been hired to do, but I'm happy to help in that communication any way I can. You know, I understand that.
I would appreciate it. That would go, I'll tell you what, if you want to build goodwill with us and build bridges, and you being a voice for that would be something we would all really appreciate. And I'm assuming all of my fellow trustees are nodding their heads right now. Yeah. And, you know, so COLA parity, I'd love to see a slide on how much of the city's contributions go towards funding the COLA. The city employees have gotten 27% COLA adjustments, I think, since 2017, and our retirees have gotten zero. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is to create parity. And I know all the counter arguments of their separate plans, et cetera, but, that's something we feel very strongly about.
On that point, yeah, this, unless there's additional comment, I think that's a good place to leave it. Okay.
What I'm hearing going forward is that I believe, and you can answer this, has the city engaged you further in representing them in discussions with both ERF and Dallas Police Fire Pension?
Is the question, has the city hired us? Going forward? No, not yet.
I have a question regarding your role. Could you define why you were engaged with the city? In other words, were you engaged to interpret the actions of the board and explain the portfolio layout or our future portfolio plans, or were you hired to also provide us recommendations on how we should be managing this portfolio, this fund?
Right. So technically, you manage the fund, right? And you may or may not want our opinion. We can't manage the fund. We're not fiduciary to the fund.
Right. So if you could just explain clearly what you were hired to do, what your scope of performance is here. Because it would be helpful to the board to understand exactly what you are conveying to the city and the purpose of that.
This is what we were hired to do. Now, the problem with this, like we told the city, is the deeper we get into this, the more they're going to get lost. You won't get lost, but they would.
Andy,
and it needs to be more generalized than that.
And the first one, the one of the first tenants he makes in this point in this presentation is that they're reviewing our performance to minimize the contributions to the city.
So when you see four down there, identify areas of potential risk and propose risk mitigation strategies or effectiveness of asset allocation or manager's life, all those kind of things. We're sharing those with you. You know, we have no other than that. You know, you can say no, goodbye, or that's a good idea, or some ideas. What we're proposing is we'd love to collaborate with you. And because you want to see what we're saying, obviously, we're like, hey, great. And because we're going to be able to give the city a clearer picture the more we work with you.
So, again, I just want to get clarity. Collaboration means a lot of things. Collaboration in making sure you have the appropriate information about what we are doing, or is it collaborating as in you providing advice to us or recommendations on what we should be doing as a board? Two very different things.
Let me try one. So in terms of looking at it, collaboration and providing advice, no, we are not a fiduciary in this situation providing advice. You have the board, you have IAC, you have Makita, you have staff. We have ideas, and we're happy to share those ideas, but in terms of looking at this, the sense that I had when this was brought to us was there's a, and I've been a consultant to a lot of public plans and everything, there was a perhaps breakdown in communication and trust on both sides, and the idea is how do we improve it? Nick asked the question, did we have a conversation, you know, why didn't the city do something 6 years ago, et cetera. Again, that's rearward looking. It would have been great if there would have been this kind of discussion 5 years ago between the board, staff, and the city council to say, we've got this water, this cliff coming, and we've got to start planning for it and do a better job with it. And so the thought is, how can we do a better job communicating, get rid of innuendos, get rid of miscommunication, make sure we have the facts, right, and show that these plans going forward are going to be able to generate reasonable returns given capital market assumptions. I mean, if the equity market goes down 30%, obviously assumptions are changed, right? But in terms of looking at it, it would be ability to communicate there and ability coming back to try and take some of the heat out, if you will. If you think about it. Yes, ma'am.
I have some experience. I've seen your resume a little bit. So do you think part of the issue that I've had with a lot of this report is the apples to oranges comparison? Do you think it's appropriate to compare our plan, because there were several slides that say that we're in the lowest quartile on a national, on a state, and a big city level, when these plans are all differently funded, different assumption rate ratios, and different asset allocations? Do you think it's appropriate comparison?
Gosh, I'm putting my hat back on when I was with the Houston police. It's a situation where you have a very unique situation, right?
Exactly.
You have all these big legacy assets and everything else. I think it's reasonable and fair if you were to look at your ex-private markets or non-performing assets, if you think about it that way, and see what it looks like. There has to be something, if you look at it, and it's not in this report, but it's also Makita's provided this report for you all, and it was in one of the new slides, is looking at the performance that Makita uses for $1 billion-plus plans, right? Now, there, they are not looking at those plans based upon funded ratio or anything else, but they provide that because that's the kind of the information that you have. And so in terms of looking at it, I guess it's a data point. It's a point of reference. Fair is maybe in the eye of the beholder because, you know, your circumstances and situation, bear with me, your circumstances and situations are very different than ERF here. They're different than a lot of the other funds because of both funded status, but primarily less funded status and more because of the handcuffs of the legacy assets, right?
So my question to you is, and this is in a statement that said in a public forum that given our funding ratio, I mean our funding status, that we right now potentially or have the ability and should have the ability to perform the same way as that Houston fund. You believe so, that they are almost 90% funded and we are 39% funded. Do you think that we can achieve the same type of performance numbers that they do?
So let me put on a shaky consultant hat here. And that is, if you are 90% funded, theoretically, you're taking risk off the table. You are less aggressive than you would be if you need to have return achieve your objectives, right? Because if you're 90% funded, you have only a little ways to go to close that gap. You don't need to get as much investment return as if you were 70% funded, for example. At 40% funded, there you have a situation where how are you going to close that gap? And the answer is that you have only so many sources of return or money. One is contributions. Two is a significant contribution by the governing body, the city of Dallas. And three is to increase the contributions. And four is to increase returns, right? So if one of those levers is not as readily available as others, then you have to rely a little bit more on the return aspect of it, right? So that's the issue. In terms of fair, you have, I don't know, Makita says that they have 50 or 60 plans that are in that universe that they provide and they show where you all perform. And I'm sure that if you asked your consultant, there's almost nobody else there in that universe that has the circumstances that the DPFP has. So in terms of...
It's an unfair comparison.
I'm saying that it's by fair...
It's an appropriate comparison.
What I'm saying is it's a data point. And I think that in terms of looking at fair, I think that's a... I hear where you're coming from. I understand it.
I'm just saying not even fair or unfair. I'm saying appropriate in an analysis.
Here's why it's appropriate, if you don't mind.
Sure.
In my mind, it's a goal. We want to be there. Houston MEPS had problems, and then they got a big contribution, and then they changed what they were doing, and that's where they are now. Is it fair to compare them to where they are now? No, it's not. You're absolutely correct. But it's a goal. This is where we want to be. We want to be a top quartile fund. We want to have 10 wins as a football team this year. We don't want to be compared to the 0-10 teams and see what they're doing. We want to see what these other people are doing and see if we can get there.
I would like to make one point about that. But this has been the analysis, the comparison that's led or has kind of been intimated that we are not doing our job.
No one has said you're not doing your job. We were specifically requested by the city, hey, will you compare us to Houston MEPS? They requested that. Okay.
Let me ask the question about Houston MEPS then, because I know the Houston police, they were 60 something percent funded. They received $1 billion
right
from the city. So if the city of Dallas wanted to give the Dallas Police and Fire Pension $1 billion, I think then you can compare them to Houston police. Houston MEPS, I know they were underfunded at one point. I know Houston Fire was pretty much at a healthy place and they took a hit because everybody else. What was Houston MEPS? What was the injection of money for Houston
MEPS? The point is they had a plan to do something with the money.
What was the injection of money for Houston MEPS? You said they were given a large...
I don't remember exactly what it was.
But they were given a significant sum of money to help them. So if the city of Dallas wanted to give a pension obligation bonds or give $1 billion or $500 million, I think it's a valid comparison. I think making that comparison right now, I don't know what MEPS was funded at. I know Houston Police was funded in the 60th percentile, 63%, I believe. I know Houston Fire at the time was in 80th percentile. So comparing our fund at 40% to those funds, it is a ridiculous comparison.
I hear you, but you're not hearing me. The city is going to have to write a check. The city's got to give you some money. So the question is, what is your Houston MEPS plan to get to the top quartile if you got a big check?
Agreed.
It's real simple.
Agreed. I agree with you. Right? Like, you want to know a plan. To their point, you're comparing a pre-funded status, us, 100%. People who got capital injection. So it's a little disingenuous.
Yes.
But if you look at your slide five, that maps out, the things that you were hired for. Number five is the one I want to focus on. Evaluate the effectiveness of the current asset allocation strategy. So nowhere in this conversation, and you've said it a few times, you don't know what our plan is. Well, that number five asks you to evaluate the effectiveness of our strategy, which is what is our plan going forward. So when you take that out of the analysis, because it wasn't done in the analysis, it just becomes, to your point, a snapshot, a point in time that points out these things without, on the other side of the balance, showing what the plan forward is. So it gives an unfair impression that they don't have a plan, that they're stuck in this point in time, and with that number five really being omitted, like saying, hey, you guys got a 5% target, that is not the same as understanding what the effectiveness of the strategy is.
I agree.
Correct. So in my view, a fulsome analysis, this is running short, and the area that it's heavy on is on the point in time where you guys are at. What it's light on is what your plan and conveying to all those who are reading it, the board, the city council, whoever, that they actually have a competent plan moving forward. And that impression is damning. And that is where the problem is. So it's like, okay, this is a partial report. And the part that's missing is the part that would give people confidence in the people sitting around the board and on the IAC. That's a big problem.
Yep. You knocked the ball out of the park. I 100% agree with you.
Mr. Wiley, I have been a big proponent of being very cautious in private markets because that's exactly where this fund got in trouble. And so we have been very cautious and prudent. Can you hear me?
Not very well. I'm sorry.
They've been cautious because that's what caused the trouble with the fund was the private market.
Right. Oh, I understand
that. It doesn't mean that we are paralyzed on that front. It means that we recognize this is how the fund got to where it was. And I watched your presentation, and at no given point was that ever made clear to the city council, is that it is in private markets where this fund went under. And so in this area where you have been very critical about, our strategy or allocation on that front. I think the messaging is convoluted at best because it is an area that we are highly attuned to. And in moving forward, we want to be as prudent, as cautious, given the history that this fund has had on that asset class.
There's only two. I want to get back to the other point about benchmarking because, and if we are going to move forward, I think that has been one of my issues. I get crushed. Compare us to the appropriate peer group. Mm-hmm. You have given. I went through this last report, and I realized that you had given ERF the ability to provide you with appropriate peer groups. You say on the benchmark,
yes,
that you sat down and that they were able to give you to work with you in a handpicking peer groups. How is that appropriate with us throwing us in with the whole pension world?
And this should be the last question in the interest of time, if that's right. We covered a lot of ground.
If I may be so bold as to suggest that the question about number five is good. I mean, when you look at current, that's what you have. The plan going forward would be future plan, which we were not made privy to, and so that would have been helpful. And in terms of looking at it, I was not part of the individual discussions, but the discussion with ERF, they did provide a peer group, and I think we would be more than happy to take a look at suggestions that you all and staff would make as to how you see appropriate peer groups. It's a little less, you can't get granular down to everybody else who's 39% funded, but people who are less than 50% or 55% funded, those kinds of things,
but
you can take a look at.
But not a Houston municipality employee.
That was a specific request.
Okay.
Don't you want to be independent?
At the risk of offending our employer, The city didn't take all of our advice. First advice, the city did not take all of our advice about A, what the scope of this ought to be, B, how it ought to be approached, C, about the public part of it, and D, you know, less, we didn't get enough input from you guys. We got some, but not near what we need, okay? We didn't advocate that. They did. We got a time crunch. We got to get this done. Do what you can, okay? Nick acknowledged it. It's breach. It's a breach. We're a breach baby on how this is done. But the point is the intention is pure. We want to help. You know, we're citizens of Dallas just like you are, and we care. That is our only motivation. It's hard to watch this after 20 years, and if we can help in any way, we'd love to. If you have all the answers, great. We just want to increase the transparency and communication so that it's conveyed and so that everyone knows and you don't feel like everyone's attacking you. I'm sympathetic to that, and I understand.
Can I make a statement? I just want to put something on the record just so that the people listening and plan participants understand. You mentioned the point, you know, if you're 90% funded generally, you do start to defease your portfolio, which is take risk off as you roll in, you're close to your 100%. And if you're at a lower funded status, then arguably that assumes that you're adding on risk. But so, but, you know, yeah, well,
I would say
it's a sweet
spot. About reducing risk and increasing.
Yeah, yeah. There's a sweet spot, right?
Yeah.
And you're talking about asset liability managing that in that little bit below, say, 85, maybe to around 60. You probably are where you are in your nice sweet spot of adding on risk, and you can be slightly more aggressive to try to bump it up. Once you drop to a certain level, there is a real risk that, you know, below 50, 40%, that one wrong move kills your plan. So in terms of being conservative at 39%, it's not a foregone conclusion that you would look at the allocation and try to load on risk, because as you know, when you model things out on the asset liability, you know, time frame, you know, down months add months and sometimes years to get back to funded status, where an up month may only take off a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Right, so it's just how the math works. Like if you go down 10%, it's not recouping 10% that gets you back to your basis. You got to outperform 10% just to get back to the money you lost. That's just how the math works. So at 39%, you want to be really careful about your downside risk, because it'll kill your plan faster than the incremental dollars of having a few additional wins. And so we've been, you know, really deliberate in the conversation of what does that mean for building the portfolio. I agree, if we were at 65% funded status, then we would take some additional risk. At 39%, I think it requires everybody to be really prudent and to walk the plan through step by step.
Yeah, I think we all agree it's a work in progress, and there's going to continue to be dialogue as we go forward. And you know, we are cut short on time.
I only ask that the courtesies and the process and the methodologies that are availed to ERF is also applied to us as well. And I also would like to end on a good positive note, because your slide 20 at least says something nice about us.
Slide 20. Good.
That despite the issues of, like, you know, splitting hairs on the public side, that we are doing some things right, according to you.
Yes.
So with that, we'd like to thank you all for your time and conversation, and we look forward to additional dialogue as we go forward.
Thank you all.
Thank you, and here's to better days.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, so we want to keep on track. So the next issue is Ryan, portfolio update.
Okay, Christine's going to come up here. That. If anyone wants to be privy to our plan, they can hang around and listen.
More media, huh? Congratulations.
That's robust.
How
to
be?
I know.
Yeah, my
good.
Well, the answer is over.
for everyone's patience with that item. We'll get into the portfolio update. Christina's going to lead it today. And then we have an item on the investment policy statement after this.
Can we say that again, Ryan?
I said Christina's going to lead the portfolio update today as people filter out. And then we'll move into the investment policy statement, which we put a lot of work into the last few months.
Nice.
Sorry.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for leading that, Tom. Appreciate it.
Moving on, so portfolio update. So as of end of October, our year-to-date return is 7.6% for the total TPSP portfolio, 11.5% for the public portfolio, which makes up 76% of the assets. As you all know, since election, the market has moved quite a bit. So as of yesterday, our portfolio actually moved up additional $50 million. So we'll get into that a little bit later. So liquidation of private market assets remains a top focus. So year to date, we have received approximately $64 million of distribution, with $36 million coming from Lone Star CRA asset sale back in September. Custodian transition is planned for January 1st of next year. We've been working very closely with BNY, the new custodian bank. And lately, as we are getting closer to the transition date, we've been working very closely with JP Morgan on that as well. But everything is on track right now. So rebalancing actions back in October, because of the proceeds that we received from private market asset sales, we rebalanced $40 million private market proceeds into investment-grade bonds, bank loans, and global equity, specifically the passive fleet of the global equity portfolio.
And based on the updated asset allocation that was approved last month, we have a little bit more that we're going to pull out of EM equity and EM debt to get down to the new targets by year end.
So in terms of initiatives, investment initiatives, so we've been talking to the IAC and the board about planning for private market investment. So as Ryan mentioned, we're going to talk to you all about investment policy statement, proposed changes to the investment policy statement, and discuss when to initiate new private market investment. And then looking beyond this year, in the first quarter of 2025, we plan to have a private credit pacing plan, and we will also discuss public equity and public credit asset class structure with the board and IEC, and we will also potentially conduct a financial search. And then second quarter and beyond, we plan to have a private equity pacing plan. And this is exciting for us too, to initiate new private market investment. So we have included some, charts. So this chart looks at market movement immediately following the election outcome. So as of November 6th, Wednesday, post the election outcome, certain parts of the market have moved drastically. So notably, U.S. equity, particularly small cap equity, went up 5.8%. The market has further moved as of yesterday. I think small cap went up close to 10%, and large cap went up about 5%. And Bitcoin immediately after the election outcome shot up 9%. And then if you look at inflation expectations, has gone up 0.13%, and 10-year treasury yield has gone up 0.16%. So I think investors are pricing in a more attractive business environment, especially for smaller domestic corporations. And we are also looking at a stronger economic growth and inflation outlook with the new administration. And for cryptocurrencies, I think investors are expecting a easier regulatory environment for crypto. So this chart looks at the U.S. budget deficit. Several of us were at the Texas Alts conference yesterday, so I think the U.S. budget deficit is top of mind for many investors. So this is as of end of, this is looking at U.S. Budget deficit as a percentage of GDP. This is as of 2023. I think for 2024, we are approaching 7%. And this does not include interest payment on our national debt. So this is despite the U.S. economy being on a very solid footing currently. So the U.S. deficit is among is the biggest among the OECD countries. The interest payment on our national debt, the annual interest payment on our national debt is bigger than defense, Medicare, Medicaid individually. So there has been speculations as to how the new administration is going to influence monetary policy going forward. But I think for budgetary items, the consensus is that given the fact that Republican Party is going to control both houses and the presidency, this will likely lead to greater fiscal stimulus going forward. And the new administration is going to favor extending all the expiring provisions of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, which might lead to bigger deficit going forward. So that remains to be seen.
What are all these Elon Musk cuts that he says in the deficit? Is that just a tour? This is a high deficit. These things are increasing.
Medicare drives the deficit. Until someone touches Medicare, it's not going to do anything to the deficit. It makes up the entitlement programs, the Department of Defense spending makes up, what, 90% of the federal budget?
Oh, wow.
So yeah. If someone has the political willpower to do something about Medicare, it's not going to do anything about the deficit.
The only thing I would, I saw something yesterday that said that they had to appoint two people to head the Department of Government Efficiency.
Yes.
That overly efficient.
Well put.
So, as we all know, the U.S. Equity market is highly concentrated. The top 10 companies make up approximately 36% of the S&P 500. This is an interesting chart that looks at NVIDIA's market cap. NVIDIA's market cap is larger than the total market cap of Canada, UK, France, Germany, and Italy. So that's pretty remarkable. So this is a chart that we look every month. So there's seems to be a divergency among U.S. equity returns versus other parts of the world, especially emerging markets. So in terms of performance snapshot, so as I mentioned, year to date for the year to date for the the return of the public part of the portfolio is 11.5. Our public equity part of the portfolio slightly underperformed index because of the quality bias of some of our managers. I also want to highlight WCM. We recently hired WCM about a month ago, actually. A year ago. And they have performed quite strongly, outperforming their index by over 700 basis points. Eastern Shore, which is a small cap manager, they've been struggling over the past couple of years, but this year they have, year to date, they have outperformed their index by over 500 basis points. In terms of the performance of our fixed income portfolio, we are solidly out of the index by 500 basis points. Loomis Sale, which is a high yield manager that's been struggling for the past couple of years, here to date, they're ahead of their index. So this is a bridge chart. As I mentioned, as of yesterday, our NAV is actually $50 million than what's showing on this chart, given the movement in the market.
Well, sorry, I'm just curious. What was the – I know we're in a better place than this, but it's a decent size. What was the change? What happened that made us lose a little bit? I mean, was there anything specific, or was it just normal market movement, or what?
Running the $50 million month to date, or what part?
Well, basically from, you know, last month we were $40 million more, I mean, basically.
So. Okay, so the markets were, if you go back to the one-month slide, it was cash outflows, and then I think, go back to the snapshot. Yeah, I mean, it was the $10 million a month of outflows. I know the EM performance took quite a hit. I think it was down 6% in the month. So I think it was a combination of the global equity. Global equity was down 2.2, public equity was down 2.5. So October performance on the public side plus the cash outflows.
Okay. Because I know people are going to ask.
Yeah.
You go from 9% up.
Well, yeah, no, it's like that 2 billion level. We've been hovering around that. Yes. And it's like if we can stay above that, it 100%. Feels pretty healthy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So obviously, like she said, ever since the election, it's been nice. But, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
I think it's like it started only going one way, maybe.
Yeah.
Is that where you need?
No, go back to, I think it's 175, what page?
Yeah, we're 179.
There you go.
There we go, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
So is there any questions on this? Additional questions?
There's that explanation. Okay. Appreciate it.
So, and this is a chart we've been looking at. So since 2018, the net private market inflows have covered 90% of net asset outflows. So in terms of safety reserve dashboard, as of end of last month, we have $165 million in cash and short-term fixed income investments. And this is projected to cover 19 months of net benefit outflow. So this is asset allocation detail as of end of October. This is post the rebalancing that I talked about previously. So if you look at the broad asset class categories, we are close to target for public equities and public fixed income Where we are over allocated is the private market investment. This is another chart showing the actual allocation.
All right. Any other questions on the portfolio? All right. Thank you, Christina. I'll get into some investment policy for Zach here now. So we've been on this process that started kind of beginning of the year with asset allocation in January and February with IAC. We looked at a lot of options over the course of the summer. We brought a recommended asset allocation mix back to the board for approval last month, which will go effective 1/1/25. So we need to update the IPS to include the new asset allocation. Alongside that, we've officially engaged Allborn and had to do a lot of work trying to figure out what the process is going to look like with the new private market consultant, planning out for diligence, oversight, approval of new private market investments. So there's kind of a few big areas of the IPS that we need to update to incorporate both the asset allocation changes and the plans for the private market portfolio.
And for, as it relates to the team, are you allocating some analysts to do that versus others on the private side? How are you using that?
Given Christina's experience at Fort Worth being in practice in the private markets the last 7 years, she's going to help on lead the private credit portfolio, which I think we're going to be making the first initial investment. But we're trying to, like, we're all generalists on the team, so we're trying to split it up where everyone still has some public market coverage and some private market coverage. The bulk of the work this year, I think, will be in private credit. And private equity is probably maybe a secondary fund, but we're going to be a little bit, a few months ahead on the private credit side.
And the engagement with Allborn is on the due diligence process?
I mean, with Allborn, they're covering then all of the private market portfolios, including reporting. So we started paying them, you know, officially working with them this summer. So we've been, you know, they've had some input on the investment policy statement.
Okay.
The first big work product, I would say, would be the pacing plan that's going to go to the IAC in January. We're working with them right now to get onboarded. They're going to do all the They're taking over all the private markets reporting from Makita, so we're doing a lot of kind of back-end work right now to get them up to speed, and they're taking over reporting for all of the investments, including the legacy, so just kind of onboarding on that front.
Does that include ongoing monitoring of, like, ODD for strategies we choose?
Yeah, so that's part of the contract. There's, I think we have access to 6 ODD reports per year. So I think once we get to the final stages of diligence in the private market pipeline is when we would kind of provide ODD reports and dig into those.
Gotcha.
So if first investment is going to be in private credit, where are we on that?
So we're kind of, Christina and team, we're starting to meet with the managers, talk to Allborn about their ideas. We have access to their database so we can see what managers they rate highly. We went to the Allborn Client Conference in October, so we met with 3 different private credit managers when we were up there on that trip. So I think the pacing plan is going to outline, like, how much this year we're going to do in private credit, and then also what areas do we want to do X amount in direct lending, do we want to do, you know, how much in opportunistic. So I think that's going to dictate kind of where we go with it, but we're starting to evaluate some opportunities. All right, so everyone has a printout of the red line of the IPS, which you can follow along. I try to put together a presentation that summarizes the key changes to it, pointing out specific sections. So, we last updated this October of 23, major changes to the private markets program, long-term asset allocation, some updated Texas Pension Review Board guidance on investment policy statements that we needed to incorporate in here. We covered with the IAC at the September meeting kind of the key changes, and then we have the full red line to review today.
Let me just add, the red line is kind of extensive because really the IPS hasn't really been, I mean, there's been specific areas that have been changed, but it hasn't really been looked at since We put it in 15 or 16, so we kind of took a fresh look at it, and we all did. And
we had minor across the last 7 years, but it's pretty.
It's pretty, you know,
yeah.
We decided to look at a bunch of, you know.
I would say like in 17, we did a comprehensive kind of rewrite.
Yeah, that's right, we did.
With the new board and IAC, but like this is the most comprehensive kind of redline of it and additions to it since then.
That's right, like in 2018, right after the new board came on board.
So this is somewhat minor, but at the beginning, we simplified to a single goal, which is to earn investment return that's sufficient to meet obligations of the plan. There was a constraint listed on item C here about ongoing liquidity needs and time horizon, given the weak actuarial funded ratio. We took that out given the move to the ADP funding that this board has approved and the city has approved their own plan on. Okay, so ask the
question. I hate to ask, but in the worst scenario, I don't mean to open up a warm, but like for the ADC, if we went with theirs and whatever, when is the expectation for that money? Like 2026, the end of 2025, in theory. So in the worst case, after we go back and forth and say, no, that calculation's not right, that right?
Well, what I was going to talk about during the next item was based on the plan the city adopted and what they told to the PRB is they were going to start paying for that in October last month. So we should have had two pay periods, but they failed to do so. They did not pay for it. And they were going to pay based on their plan, not our plan, but they didn't increase it. The city CFO talked to me actually at the court hearing and came over really quickly and said, we know we didn't pay you. We're trying to figure it out. And then in the court hearing, they said that they had paid it. But they're two payments behind. So we're still getting our 34.5%.
So they're moving forward on their plan.
They say they are, but we haven't received.
I didn't want to derail you, but I just wanted to make sure that we understand how important this is because the money's coming in.
It's good to know they're trying to figure it out, though.
Ryan, I just wanted to clarify your comment about private credit being the first step. Is that from Allborn's recommendation versus... You know,
it's more from the asset allocation. We got 0.2%. We have two very small private credit funds. So we have more room in the asset allocation there with the new 4% target private credit versus. So it's less kind of our view of the market and what's next. The asset allocation, we moved the HUF to its own asset class, which creates a little bit of room. Private equity, but we have less room allocation-wise to make new investments there. So I think it's just kind of up first from that standpoint.
So does Auburn just provide you a list, or are you working together?
Christina, do you want to talk to kind of on your views on the pipeline and how that will work together with Auburn?
Yeah, so we have a standing meeting with all the other week. Meet with all and discuss various topics. So, we've talked about working together with all one, curating sort of a pipeline list of potential investments. We're going to discuss those. These are going to be highly rated funds by all one that are in the market. And then we take the pipeline to the IAC to get feedback. And then, and Ryan's going to get into this later in this ITS discussion, the IAC is going to designate a subcommittee to evaluate the pipeline investments. And then upon IAC's approval and recommendation, subcommittee, we're going to bring this potential investment to the board for you all. By statute, any private market investment requires eight votes from the board. Mm-hmm. So every investment has to be approved by the board, by this board. So in terms of due diligence, we think that we're going to work jointly with Allhorn on this investment due diligence side. Staff is going to do our own investment due diligence. We're going to do our own legal review.
Just get it to handle the legal review.
Anyway, so Initial, right. So, but on the operational due diligence side, you know, Allpoint is very well known for their very robust ODD capability. So, you know, our proposal is that we're going to lean more on Allpoint on ODD. We're kind of constrained on our internal resource. We view Allpoint as an extension of staff. So, you know, the IAC is going to be provided with, you know, all the reports, IDD, ODD, all the reports for you all's evaluation. And as far as what, you know, as far as getting board approval, we'll provide due diligence reports for you all to look at as well. So that's kind of process. But as Ryan was saying that, we think the pacing plan is kind of the starting point so that we can decide in terms of the number of commitments, the size of our commitments, the strategy that we want to commit to going forward.
Yeah, and I would
those are my follow-up questions. Size, okay.
And I would say, like, when we hired Allborn, when we made the decision on what private market consultant to hire, I think given the history in private markets and kind of restarting new programs, the idea was we would rely pretty heavily on Allborn's underwriting of new fund investments, and we wouldn't be kind of sourcing our own ideas at least in the initial years of the program. So everything that would come to the subcommittee would be kind of a dual recommendation between something that Allborn likes in the space and is underwritten. I would say their grading's a little bit tougher than some other consultants, so it's just because it's got a letter by it, doesn't, like, it'll only be funds they recommend and like that we're bringing through the subcommittee.
And I am very, very confident in Christina's Wu's experience and ability to spearhead this, so very excited. Okay.
All right. So asset class structures, what we want to do there, we have a provision currently in the policy that says for any asset class, public asset class that has multiple underlying strategies, think public equity right now, we would do an asset class structure that would go to the board. What that has actually looked like in practice the last 7 years has been a presentation from Akita every couple of years to say that we're going to have X amount in passive and 6% targets to global equity, and we're going to add some small cap over here, but it's all been contained within a presentation from Makita. What we want to do is to make it more clear, and since we're having public credit be its own kind of standalone broad asset class with underlying strategies, we've updated the language to say that we're also going to have ranges on all those manager targets that will come through the asset class structure. And we're going to turn it into more of a policy document that the board approves, where there's a presentation outlining kind of all these considerations in the asset class from staff and or Makita, and then there'll be a short document that actually outlines targets, implementation considerations, ranges, manager strategies that will be used to build out that asset class. On safety reserve and rebalancing, so we have been talking internally with Makita for a while now about the merits of increasing the flexibility in our rebalancing language. So like Josh said, the last time we kind of rewrote this policy was in 17, and it requires, in order to do any rebalancing, move toward target and approvals, written approvals and recommendations from both staff and consultant, which is, I think, both rigid and requires multiple levels of approvals to do any rebalancing. So we've updated language, we moved the safe reserve stuff into its own section, and we've made it clear that we can rebalance within the ranges that we set for each asset class, which could include tactical moves, which we don't plan to do, but it's allowed, and I think it's needed to be allowed under the policy so we have the appropriate flexibility to rebalance when needed. But it still requires every recommendation on rebalancing requires both general consultant and Kelly's approval before we move money. So that's probably the biggest change in terms of operational aspects of the policy. So any concerns, questions there?
Is there any language that would, and I know we discussed this, and please forgive me because I can't totally remember it, but like at what point we get to start considering taking reserve, like that allocation to reserve out, or like, and is that a board decision or staff decision? Or Alborn as well? I mean, like,
We talked about internally scrapping the whole, just the name of the safe reserve, because really it's an allocation to short-term port bonds.
Exactly.
As the net cash outflow decreases as we move to ADC funding,
right,
I think we'll have less of a need. Our cash allocations are probably a little bit high at 3%. We only have 13% total in cash in investment-grade bonds. So I don't think we're...
So my point is that it no longer is a reserve. It's more like an allocation to more liquid.
Yeah, it's like the conservative part of the portfolio. So I think over time, as we get more surety on funding, it, to answer your question directly, it's an asset allocation decision. So it is what targets go to those asset classes as part of the asset allocation approved by the board, which then goes into the policy. But we talked about it, I think, next time around as the funding situation's improved and the net cash outflows are less, we'll look again at probably not less investment-grade bonds, but maybe longer duration, less short duration, less cash needed in the portfolio. So there's the full updated rebalancing language, updated long-term asset allocation, so we have all the new targets in here with the new asset class weight and benchmark. I should say, and it's on the discussion sheet, but the plan on the IPS and what we talked about last month on the asset allocation is everything would go effective 1/1/25. So these changes would be approved today, but effective beginning of the year. On the private market provisions, we added a whole section in 5F on the private markets consultant, splitting that role out from the general consultant. We added a section in 7B on the selection process, including what we just covered on the annual pacing plan, the subcommittee, and the board approval process. We reviewed and made no changes to the concentration limits in the private markets portfolio, and then we added a section on quarterly consultant reporting requirements on private markets.
Hey, Ron, forgive me if I missed this in the prior meeting. Policy benchmarks, how was that determined for the private credit?
We talked both on private equity and private credit about using either kind of private indices or public plus a adder. We talked to Alborn about it. We felt, that what we have here is a mix of high yield and bank loans plus 1.5%. We've had some discussion on what the appropriate liquidity premium was on the benchmark and kind of, we felt 150 was still appropriate.
Let me just tell you.
It's been decreasing over time.
In the fund that I manage as private credit, I use 50-50 high yield leverage loans with no spread on top of that. It's an aggressive benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about the upside, and that's why I say this just as, like, before we get in there, maybe we don't want to box ourselves in, have another conversation with Alborn about the implications of that. The upside of high yield and leverage loan, as you guys know, is equity-like returns. I mean, you're talking mid-teens. High yield can run. Leverage loans can run. Now, the bottom side might be a negative 10%. So it's a big range. But when you're talking about a benchmark and then you're adding 150 in private credit, sure, you want to take risk to get some return. But how much risk are you willing to take to beat that benchmark? It might put you in this box where you're taking undue equity-like risk in your private credit bucket.
Mm.
I thought it was a great benchmark but now 2 years in, I'm like, I don't know if that's a great benchmark. So just from the implications of what it pushes me to do when I'm looking at the landscape of prudent investing. So it can be. So just want to ask Alborn about that because, you know, private credit is broadening out now and you guys might find yourself wanting to diversify in that bucket and give, like, once you're a little high on direct lending or something and want to move in another area. And that benchmark will constrain all but your highest returning private credit. And there may be other diversification reasons that you go into something a little lower. So I just throw that out there for your consideration and discussion with Alborn that it is an aggressive benchmark. It's up I mean, 50-50 this year is like through three quarters is up like 12. So you're talking about you're going to get 14 in your private credit bucket?
Sheesh.
Right? Like, it's just an aggressive benchmark, and really over a cycle will be a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, my view is kind of the public credit, private credit is going to merge over time anyways.
Just going to bring the returns further down, right? So
I think
that's true, right?
And high yield lever loans are the highest risk of that public credit space. So it's,
yeah. We'll discuss more internally because I think the other consideration is it's not going to be easy to, once you set a 150, to backtrack on that.
Yeah. It works now with SOFR at whatever. But
yeah.
What would be the argument of not using a conservative benchmark?
Yeah, I've heard it outside groups say one way to improve performance is to use better benchmark. But
I mean, if you'd ask me like what my suggestion to be solution oriented, it would be high yield or leverage loan is fine. Maybe you pair that with the ag though. Because if you're thinking about where you may be pulling money from in your rebalance, that may be a more nuanced, and then putting a spread on top of that. But that's just, I mean, obviously smart folks can disagree on that, well-meaning folks can disagree on that, but I'm just throwing that out there.
I think you make really good points, and if the board does decide to approve this, which you don't have to today, but we can come back next month after we've reconsidered it, you make really good points.
Yeah, and to that point, we're in theory, we should be stepping into this very conservatively as well. So it's not going to be these like really, you know, these like equity-like deals. We should probably.
But don't get me wrong. 2 years ago, it was down 6. No matter what you did, you would have looked like a genius. Mm-hmm. But it's up 12 now, so the swing is massive, and you don't want to be managing your, even though it's private credit, you just don't want to be managing your credit bucket for those kind of equity-like swings.
To Tina's question, Ryan, if I could, just like a couple of the, you know, in terms of conservativeness, you know, we're taking this complexity and illiquidity premium within private credit that we don't within high yield or leverage loans to the same extent. So I think for that, we need to demand a higher level of return. And if the answer is, well, private credit is going to earn you the same as high yield or leverage loans, we should be asking, why are we doing private credit? So I think there's a strong argument to be made that holding your private credit managers to a high standard, you know, this is just the benchmark. We're going to compare them to a whole bunch of different things at the end of the day, and I think it's good to set a high bar.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I understand holding them to a high standard, but it's credit. This is not equity. There's not unlimited upside. It's dictated by the market. You have an index, reference rate, and a spread. And so a high standard in a down cycle may only get you 8. That may be the high standard. The high standard shouldn't be compare your credit bucket to your equity bucket. You're going to get yourself in the problem, right, trying to get equity-like returns in your credit bucket. Now, right, everybody has recency bias. SOFR's 5. I can get 12 in my credit. So you say a high standard is teens. It looks great. But if you think about credit over the long term, that's not what you should expect out of your credit bucket. You should not be expecting long-term cycle returns in your credit bucket, private or otherwise, to look like your equity bucket. So high standard in credit becomes very relative because it's capped upside, and the goal in any credit is always to protect the downside. So overly aggressive benchmarks, I just don't think they serve you in your decision-making. They will look great at some times, but if you think about what it incentivizes your decision-making, I don't think that is... That needs to be discussed. What is the incentives of my benchmark? And having a more full cycle tested, balanced benchmark doesn't mean you're not holding your managers to a high standard. It just means that you are aware that you are investing for the long term and that the cycle changes. That's my only point.
What I would propose is let's talk to all board and think about it a little bit more internally. I understand what you're saying. I think it's some premium, but what's the right premium above the public market? I think another avenue we could do is maybe make it part of the pacing plan that we're working with Allborn that goes to ISC in January to kind of do a more robust analysis of the right benchmark and come back at that time. But
I think there could also be a distinction of private credit versus opportunistic credit.
Mm-hmm.
Your opportunistic is going to have a private equity component on it, and so you're going to have a higher return.
Yeah, because if you end up going into something like you want to do some asset-based loans where you think it's good safety there and it's on equipment or hard assets, without taking a lot of leverage, those traditionally are not going to be in these teens areas. You might think it's attractive for the protections, and it might be a lower environment in terms of SOFR, and that may have no correlation to what levered loans and high yields yeah. doing, right? Like, so now you're chasing, and I just don't think you, if you're going to pick a risk somewhere in your book, you know, chase with equities with the unlimited upside. Don't chase with credit. It's a bad look.
Well, taking will definitely talk to all of us. But if I look at, the bank loan, Credit Suisse Leverage Loan Index, you know, over the past five years, mm-hmm. 5.9%. Mm-hmm. Year to date for our bank loan portfolio, it had returned 7.5%. So high yield is about 8%. So 50% high yield, 50% bank loan. You know, you're looking at 7-8% plus a spread of 150.
5 years ago, when rates were zero, get that 10.
Well, I'm
that was tough.
Right, yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Like, it's all constant. It's just tough. Like, right now, it's doable, but it's up this year.
Right.
It's always going to be in context with that spread. It's just, it's aggressive.
Right. So, like, year to date, bank loan had returned 7.5%.
Mm-hmm.
High yield, 7.9%. So, we're looking at, 7-8% plus a spread of 150. So, that's still, high single digit, low teen type of target return that we are looking at.
Yeah, so I'm looking at my, I'm sorry, I'm a nerd, but I got, I benchmarked the S&P lever loan, different, but 50% Bank of America high yield, 1 year, so 12 months from today, 12.59%. That's a strong credit return, that's all I'm saying. So you're gonna get equity-like vol, mm-hmm. right? That's in your benchmark. So it either means you keep that benchmark, and then you got to educate and prepare all of us as to what we're likely to experience in any given year to get to the 5-year balanced out average. But it is worth the committee and everyone knowing, like, hey, man, if we underperform a little bit this year, our mindset needs to be longer term. So it's a lot of different ways to play it. But.
And I mean, like, I definitely don't think that the private credit book is going to be, all direct lending, which would offer a lower, premium there. But it'll be a mix. But like you said, there could be some more conservative stuff in that mix. So I would say let's kind of bring that item back with the pacing plan, because that'll also dictate kind of what strategies we think we're going to be building that book out with. But I think that's a good time to.
Any more discussion? Any more changes?
Just two other changes I'll cover real quick. Which is updated timing from annual to periodic review. Just so this time it was 13 months that we looked at it. We clarified the IAC members can be reappointed. We added proxy language based on Texas Pension Review Board guidance. We have a public investment manager review process that we do internally that we added some language around the process that's already in place. Same thing on manager termination, added some language around processes that are already in place. And then also based on PRB guidance, we added a section on investment management fee and expense monitoring. So with that, I would have the recommendation to approve effective 1/1/25. Do we need to add anything on the benchmark?
I think we're going to come back to that.
Okay.
Because I think the language in there, I think we can still pass the investment policy changes and come back to the benchmark.
Okay.
As we choose for the credit.
Okay.
So I guess the motion would be to approve effective January 1st, 2025, the proposed revised investment policy statement. Can I get a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Second. All, anyone? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Just always a delay. Oh, okay. Motion approved. Okay. We're running behind. Sorry, Nick. I'm not doing your job well. Okay. The next is funding process update.
Tina, I think the other trustees are saying, Nick, who right now? You're doing such a great job.
Nick, you killed me today. This is not the day for you. Okay, I have a very brief presentation on the Section 2.025 funding process. We've had no further negotiations with the city, not a big surprise there. As I stated earlier, the city had said to the PRB they were going to start making the ABC contributions based on their plan, with the first payroll ending in October, which would have been two payrolls, and they haven't done that yet, although the CFO said that they would. Once they figure out how to do it, they'll...
What is the size of that?
I don't know, because I don't understand their plan.
I mean, like, is it $5 million? Is it $50 million?
I haven't calculated it.
It would be 200 and something divided by 28, right? $200 million divided by... That was...
Technically, no, because they're supposed to pay a flat amount based on the 2023 UAL as a flat amount divided by 26 pay periods, but that is not how the language reads in their plan. But I think that's what they're going to do. That's the part I don't understand. And then they're supposed to pay this fixed percentage times the actual payroll, and how those two work out for any given pay period, I don't know. But once we get it, I've asked Jack for a detailed breakdown on how they did the calculation.
And this one, I just have one logistical question, because I don't recognize. Once we start getting these payments, do they come monthly or quarterly?
Biweekly.
Oh, biweekly.
They come as, you know, when the police and fire get paid.
Oh.
The same day they get their paychecks, we get our contributions.
From the city?
From the city.
Oh, wow.
Except we have.
Right. We're getting 34.5%.
Except we have. There's been no payments at all, even the old payments.
No, we're still getting the 34.5%.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no. Believe me, if we weren't getting that, this would not be the first you're hearing of it. So there was that. We did have the hearing down in Austin on October 30th. Josh will discuss that in closed session later. On the November 7th, the city had their presentation from Deloitte on the 802 audit. Deloitte is still representing that they're independent. The board did ask for a letter from Deloitte explaining how they're independent. We haven't received that. They said they're independent. They're opinion didn't change. They signed it, and that's what they're presenting to the city. So
they did not change any of their comments?
No, they did not. We've had a couple of virtual meetings, one with the PRB and Senator Huffman's office, just to keep them apprised of what's going on. And then we did have another meeting yesterday or day before with the PRB to talk about actually trying to understand the city's plan. But in that, we asked, you know, they have a requirement by December 1st to provide a report to the legislature on the status of the 2.025 on if the changes that the board did. And we want to know what that was going to look like. And what they're going to do is incorporate that into this big report that they do on a biannual basis for the legislature. It'll be a page in there where they talk about that. It did indicate that they're also going to talk about the city's plan in that, so we'll see what that looks like.
In that meeting, did you get a sense of how they feel about the submission of two plans? Because when we had gone earlier in the year in front of the board, they were very, like, adamant that it was going to be, like, this collaboration and whatnot. I'm kind of interested if you got any sense of their feeling.
They haven't changed their opinion at this point.
So they would think that the city's plan is the plan?
No, they're not saying that. So I don't want to speak for the PRB, but, you know, that they have a role in the statute related to the FSRP process. We believe the FSRP process happens, you know, 9 months from now or, in September 2025. That's a lot of that is the subject of the litigation. I don't think the PRB's changed their decision on that. I don't think that impacts us at this point. It's more of a litigation.
Yeah.
I'd say that for closed session.
Well, some of it's closed session, but I mean, I think the PRB fundamentally just has a very strong view of that
you know, this is how this thing should operate. And so that's why even when we ask the question, even if the court rules that the FSRP doesn't apply and represents the city, the FSRP they indicated that they left it. So it's just one of those things.
And he did explain, which was helpful, that they basically, and this is my interpretation, are putting blinders on and doing this calculation that says if you take this funding, like the ADC funding, however you parse it, and you assume all assumptions are met every year, and you get to 30 years to fund, they're going to check that as okay, fine. I mean, they did acknowledge they can't do an FSRP if both the city and the board don't agree to it. But as far as the math calculation goes, if they take the pieces of the city's plan that have the contributions in it, and ignore the fact that contributions are voluntary and contingent on all that governance stuff, including the board, the city weighing, you know, having to approve all the actuarial assumptions, if you ignore all of that and just look at the math, sure, you can get to 30 years of fund. I mean, I could do a fixed rate contribution for 25 years and then put in maybe for the last five and call it good. So how that works out, I don't know. I don't know what it's going to look like.
And when do we hear? Or is that going to look? Have we? Is it supposed to be this week or something?
On the hearing?
Oh, that's always that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll discuss that.
Okay.
Okay. So lastly, there's just a calendar on here. There is a PRB meeting on December 4th. We're not on the agenda. They do have a topic to talk about FSRP filings, so I'm sure the city's filing will get more on that. We have a board meeting December 12th, and then the first day of the legislative session is January 14th, and we have to file any bill, which hopefully we won't need, by March 14th.
Well, all right. Moving right along. Brenda, you're next for the 2023 Annual Comprehensive Financial Report.
Thank you. I'm happy to present the Annual Comprehensive Financial Report, or as we commonly call it, the ACFR. This year's theme for our cover and all of our divider pages, really beautiful pictures, all based on Texas state themes that you'll see as we go through.
Thank you, Melinda.
She does a great job in helping us find ideas. So I'm going to review some of the highlights, the things that you'll find in the ACFR, and introduce maybe the different types of information. So perhaps the first thing you're asking is, what is an annual comprehensive financial report? It's a thorough and detailed presentation of the pension system's financial condition, and it reports on the activities and balances during the year. The ACFR, here's another great one with the sunset there. I just don't know how you can get much better than that. So Blue Bonnet is the Texas state flower, so we're going with that. An ACFR has five sections to it. It has an introduction section, a financial section, an investment, actuarial, and statistical section. And I'll take you through some highlights and maybe introduce you to some of the information you might find in there. So here we are, financial section. There's the Longhorn, who is the state large mammal. Didn't know that there was one, but there we are. The first thing that you'll see here in the introduction section is a transmittal letter. And it discusses DPFP, its history, major initiatives, funding status, 2023 results, investment portfolio, important information. Along with the transmittal letter, so it's a nice introduction, what happened this year, that's a great place to start. Along with the transmittal letter, you'll also see awards that we've earned. And in 2023, we earned the Public Pension Coordinating Council Administration Award. You'll also find trustee information and all of your smiling faces here. And the last part of the introduction section is just the administrative organization and all of our professional advisors. Then we move on to the financial section. So the audited financials that we talked about earlier today, this section is identical to that audited financial report. So we'll go through here and highlight a few items here. The first thing that you start with is the BDO report, and it's right here on page 240, on that second paragraph. There's their opinion. That's what we look for, as Jody said, clean opinion for us. So we have a couple of reports from BDO here, and then we move into the MD&A. So the MD&A is 7 pages in total. It provides, again, a high-level summary of the activities during the past 3 years. Again, another great place to start if you just want to get a summary view of what's happened. It contains these summarized combining statements of fiduciary net position. It shows a 3-year comparison. And the net position for 2023 was $1.95 billion, and it increased by $131 million over the prior year. And while the benefit payments continue to exceed contribution payments, the shortfall was offset by investment gains during 2023. Next page has the combining statements of changes in fiduciary net position. Let's see if I can get it to appear. In the top part is the city contributions. They increased by 2.9 million or 1.7% over the prior year. Computation pay was greater than the floor for all periods in 2023. So the contribution is based strictly on computation pay, or was in 2023. Member contributions increased 2.8 million or 4.7% over the prior year because of increased salaries and numbers of employees. And another thing I'd like to highlight is, let's see if I can make it happen, investments. The net investment gain was $197 million, and it was driven primarily by the increase in the private market. This same financial statement is shown on pages 252 and 253. You've got some charts and graphs here. In this presentation, it is split between the combined plan and the supplemental plan with a 2-year comparative. So this is a nice place where you can see both plans. Most of the presentation, when you see financials, they're together. Here's an opportunity to actually see them separately. The notes to the financials begin on page 254. The notes provide important information about the financial statements and the overall financial status of the plans. And here at the bottom of this page, you'll see a table that summarizes plan membership. So for the combined plan, total non-active members decreased from 6,015 to 5,952. In 2023, that's a decrease of 63, and active members increased by 46, from 5,085 to 5,131. And then here on the next page, you have the same table for the supplemental plan. Non-active members increased by 4, active members increased by 4 as well. So again, information that you don't normally see at any of our board meetings, this is the kind of thing that you can look here and find. I specifically want to mention there's a dozen notes here that are in the financials, but I want to point out note 3, which is about investments. So the investments they provide detailed information and comparisons about the investments. So this chart, you have 2023 and 2022 on it, and it's the fair value of the investment, and they increased 145 million year over year, 22 compared to 23. Also in this section, there are things like fixed income maturity tables here on page 267, or the foreign currency tables that are here that you see. And then you also have the credit rating tables here. So all of this is in note three in that first section of the financials. Towards the end of the financials, you're going to find required supplementary information. A few more pages starting right here. This has good trending schedules that show financial information for the last 10 years. So here is a schedule of changes in net pension liability and the related ratios, and you're going to get 10 years, both for the combined plan and for the supplemental plan. So that's here in the required supplementary. It also has history of plan changes, investment returns, and expenses as well. So we're going to move to the next section, which is investments. Horned Frog is a little homage to Ryan and TCU. I am also a Horned Frog as well. The first thing that you see in the investment section is the letter from Makita. And then it moves straight into the investment activities and initiatives. Here's another great table, which is the 1, 3, 5, and 10-year returns by asset category and class against the representative benchmark. You'll see it starts here on this table and then completes on the next one. For 2023, the time-weighted return was 10.3% on the overall portfolio. Been a lot of talking about asset allocation today. There's a lot of information in here about asset allocation. A couple of pages, again, and charts there. I'm going to say this is one of my favorite charts because when we talk about the work that's been done, you look at the first quarter of 2017 and you look at global equity, and we had less than 10% in global equity then. So look to where we are now. I mean, this really shows all of the great work that the board and the investment staff have put in these past few years to move the asset allocation, you know, where it should be. So I think this one really tells a story. You also see things like management fees. These tables here in 2023, pardon me, management fees were just under $7.5 million. We also have a couple of charts that talk about who are our largest public equity and fixed income holdings. You ever want to know that? It's here in 2023. That was Microsoft and Apple. And also on this page, that page was all of the investment managers are listed. Next is the actuarial information. This section is... It's highlights from the actuarial report that previously have been presented to the board. As with the other sections, it starts with a letter from Siegel describing the actuarial report. As we move through the letter, then you get to the combined funded ratio, as we've talked about earlier, 32% as of 1/1/24, and that's from a restated 34.4% at 1/1/23. It lists actuarial assumptions and methods, and I'll just kind of highlight a couple of these in here that I think could be interesting. So you'll see various charts, various tables. Here on this page is the turnover ratio. And if you look at down here where it says a 10, it also breaks down between police and fire. So the turnover ratio at 10 years is 3.5% for police and only 1% for fire. So interesting. As you continue to move down and you look, you'll see a chart about active member information. Here. So 10 years of data. What are the active members? What's their average annual pay? What's the year-over-year change? Combined and supplemental plan. As we leave the actuarial section, we're going to move into the final section, which is the statistical information. So this section provides a historical perspective, some context and detail. Again, good trending with 10-year schedules. And you'll see some of the schedules will say consolidated plan, and that's because the supplemental plan is so small. In order to guard privacy, we will combine the combined plan with the supplemental plan. You see changes in fiduciary net positions, both for combined, again, 10-year presentation, supplemental. Here's distributions by type, combined and supplemental, chart, table form. A couple of others that I think are interesting. Are benefit recipients by type. So if you wanted to say, of our members, how many are receiving a monthly benefit of $4,000 to $4,500? You just come down this chart, says, well, the total number is 508 are receiving a monthly benefit in that range. And how is that broken down by service retirements, disabilities, and so forth? So again, good information. And then one final one. Yearly retirements by service years. Again, if we go to the bottom, we see 2023. There were 143 retirements, and you can break down and see, well, 29 of those had 30-plus year service. Another 29 were in the 26 to 30. It tells you their final average salary and their average benefit. So a lot of great information. I hope this overview kind of piques your interest. And that whenever you're looking to find information on the system, the first place that you'll turn would be to the ACFR as a good place to start. The prior year reports from 2014 forward are posted on the website, so you can always go there and see them. We will be printing hard copies, and we'll have those for you at next month's meeting. We also have soft copies available. If you would like to have a soft copy. I do want to say preparing this ACFR is a group effort, and I want to specifically thank Bill and Larissa from our accounting team. They do most of the heavy lifting and putting the ACFR together. Melissa, who does a wonderful job selecting the photos, compiling the ACFR, doing all of the formatting. John, who does a great job with gathering all the data, Ryan and Akshay, who pull all of the investments section together, and of course, Kelly for her help and encouragement.
And Brenda. Great lady in the whole thing.
Great job.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We know all the work that goes into this and some of the difficulty of getting information from some of these entities. So I also recognize this is a Super Bowl of what you do. So thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. Are there any questions about the ACFR?
Nope.
Okay. So the motion authorized the executive director to issue the 2023 annual comprehensive financial report and to forward the report to the Pension Review Board, City of Dallas, and to post it on the DPFB website. Can I get a motion?
You make motion.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion approved. And then in the spirit of time, because I'm makes me very conscious of that, we're going to kind of try to plow through the next couple of things. So
My next couple of things will be short, hopefully, unless there are questions. We did the first reading of the budget at the October 2024 meeting. This is for the 2025 budget. Since that reading, we posted the budget to the website. We also sent it to the City of Dallas. That was done on October the 10th. We did not receive any feedback from the city, and we made no changes to the proposed budget since the first reading. So during this November meeting, the board may either approve the budget or direct staff to adjust the budget and bring the revised budget back to the board in December for approval. So just to quickly review, the 2025 budget is $19.3 million, and that compares to a prior year, the 2024, of $17.5. That's up $1.8 million. As we talked about, most of that is related to either one-time expenses related to funding changes or the pension administration software and imaging system. Are there any questions about the 2025 budget?
Okay. So I guess I recommend a motion to approve the proposed 2025 budget.
Make a motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion approved. Brenda?
Okay.
Quarterly financial report.
Here we are, quarterly financials. So this is a third quarter financial review, and I want to start with the bridge chart. We began the year with a net position of $1.95 billion. The investment-related transactions have increased the net position by $184.1 million, and benefits and operations-related transactions reduced the net position by $78.2 million, and our 9/30/2024 ending net position a little over $2 billion, 2.060. Happy to see that be a 2 again.
Does that get us to a 4 in the front of funding? 39 to 40, no? Did I miss that?
Not quite yet.
Okay. So, a couple of highlights from the financials. This is the combined statements of fiduciary net position, and it compares results from the end of the year, December 2023, to 9/30. And the first section is investments. Total investment value at June 30th was $1.94. That compared to 1.87 at the end of the year, an increase of about $73 million, and the increase is primarily related to market changes in equities and fixed income. As we move down the page, we look at cash and cash equivalents. They've increased $31 million since year-end due to the rebalancing back to cash of $45 million. And distributions of $57.6 million. Those were partially offset by benefits that were made during the year. And as we look at the changes in fiduciary net position, and it compares September of 2024 to September of 2023, the first section is contributions. City and member contributions have increased by $13.9 million. When compared to last year, city contributions are up $9.8 million. However, as I said previously, contributions now exceed the floor, and the contributions are all based on comp pay for this year as well, plus the additional contribution of $13 million a year that they make. Overall, member contributions increased by $4 million. and that's because of increased salaries and headcount. And headcount has increased by about 180 when compared with prior year levels. As we move down the page and we look at net investment income, it has increased by $95 million, and again, that's primarily related to the change in the public market. And finally, as we look at benefits paid to members, it's increased by $3.27 million year over year, and that's primarily due to new service retirements at higher monthly benefits. Are there any questions about the financials? No. Okay.
Thank you, Brenda. Next item, Executive Director approves pension
ministerial
actions.
Josh,
can I have
ministerial? Okay, so this is the report that I give you monthly just to show the activity on the benefit side. And we spend so much time in this meeting talking about investments and financial information sometimes, like today. And we don't talk a lot about the benefit side because it pretty much ticks along pretty well and there aren't problems or, you know, we're administering the plan. And we have some really great people. So last time I told you, I gave you a little cliffhanger that I had a little story that I wanted to say last week or last month, but we're running out of time. So as it relates to, this is how why it falls under this item, Josh, it relates to the numbers kind of on this page. There's real people behind here. And one of the stories I wanted to tell you is we have a counselor, Cynthia Thomas, who she's our longest serving counselor. And she does a great job. She got a call last month from one of our members who was in the hospital without a lot of time left. And his mind was perfectly fine. It was his body that was failing. And he wanted to know, am I better off retiring or am I better off passing away while I'm still active? So we dropped everything, we ran the numbers, and we considered the city's benefits and our benefits and what was in his best interest and his survivor's best interest. And we decided he'd be better off to join DROP. So we quickly prepared the information. We had it, you know, sent up to the hospital. The notary was there. He signed the information, came back, and he passed away the day later. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they're doing. You know, we don't have that every day, but we do have, I mean, they do great work that you guys don't see. So I just want to share that. The other thing I just want to point out on this list is retirements are way down this year, which is actually a good sign. It's 108 through 11 months this year and 144 last year, so hopefully that will continue. So any questions on this? Well, it's a young department, so we shouldn't be getting them for a long time. It should be going lower and lower.
Right.
Okay.
The next item is also mine. It's a contribution report. This item is the same as you've seen month after month, and there's really nothing abnormal here. This is still September data, so it would be based on the 34.5%. Are there any questions on this item?
No. Tag, you're up. Board member report on meetings, seminars, and conferences attended.
Yes. So I went out to NCPERS, and it was a good conference. It was basically a just kind of a reminder of best practices. I thought Houston Fire gave a great presentation on how they kind of got lumped in with Houston Police and Houston MEPS and Municipal Pension, and they got screwed. They had benefits taken away when they were healthy. They had benefits taken away when they were healthy pension. So it was a reminder. It's just nice to see we're taking the steps, you know, the everyday steps and things you can do to prevent stuff like that from happening. You know, the reason we have, you know, we have certain people that we deal with, a lobbyist and stuff, to make sure at a legislative level, a state level, a local level, we're taking the steps to prevent stuff like that from happening. So it was good. It's interesting to see how different people just manage their plans in New Jersey. Police and Fire was in the state pension. They pulled away. It was like talking to, like, if you can imagine a pension board of the Sopranos. I mean, that's literally who I thought was very cliche but entertaining. And they were interesting. And this is every conference I go to now. It's like Ryan's a rock. Everybody wants to tell me how great Ryan is. And now lately, I don't know where Kyle went, but they want to talk about how good Kyle is. So it's always encouraging to hear how good your staff is from others from all over the country and how desired they are to be part of their plan. And so it's just a reminder of how good our staff is. So it was enlightening, encouraging that we're doing the right things day to day, and that we have a very competent staff with us.
So they hear about us.
Yes. And people all over know, Ryan is a rock star. Everybody says great things about everybody's like, oh, you work with Ryan. Yeah, he's, it's interesting.
Like
of course, Tom. We know about Tom, though. Ryan's the one. Yeah. So, it was good. It was a good meeting. Yeah, good conference.
Okay, great. Thank you. We're going to hand it back to Kelly, Board Approval of Trustees Education Travel.
All right. This is your standard item. Sasha's gone through here and listed some upcoming training. If anybody wants to attend, let us know, and we can put your initials on here for board approval. Item 4 is a Tech First conference. That's always good. Item 6 on here is the ANSIPRS annual conference, which is also good. Mm-hmm. The TEDS conference is more like an all-day training. They have beginning trustee training and advanced trustee training, if you're interested in that. And then the last item on here, the Tech First Summer Forum. That's in El Paso. I think that's usually good, too. I actually haven't been to the summer forum. I've only been to their annual one. But if you have any interest, let us know. We'll get you signed up.
Okay. Still with you, Kelly? Okay, so this next item is probably the strangest thing that was added in the 2017 legislation. You've all been here for a while, so you know that on an annual basis, I have to present to you the training manual. So here we are presenting you the training manual again. And as you know, it's in Diligent, and we present it to you electronically. So I'm going through that. I need to have you acknowledge that we've gone over this item today, and also have you sign off that you've received the ethics policy and have reviewed that too. So you have those sign offs. You can sign those and give them to Melissa or just leave them at your place. That would be great. So just quickly going through the training manual.
Right.
The thing I don't like about the training manual, just to be honest, is it's not a training manual, but that's what they call it in the statute. So it's in Diligent, and it's under the Resource Center in Diligent, which when you log into Diligent, the Resource Center, you can see on the left side there, it's the third item down. You should have recently actually received an email from Melissa and then another one from Diligent, because Diligent changed people's users' names, and instead of having Melissa contact each of you and have you do this, she went ahead and gave them your email address. So they changed your username to your email address. That's what that email was about if you received it.
Yeah.
But if you go into Diligent, the third item down is the Resource Center, and then you can see the third item down from there, or the second item, is the training manual. That's where this is. And the statute lays out what has to be in this manual. And there are 8 items which are listed here, which are the chapters of the training manual. If you click on each of these items, if you go into Diligent, you'll see a little red dot or asterisk, I can't remember which it is, that indicates there's new information in there. So you'll see which of these chapters we've added information to. The different chapters, when you click on them, this is the type of information that's in there. So the first one is laws governing DPFP operations. That has our plan and the plan document for the supplemental plan. The next one is programs, functions, roles, and the budget. The prior year budget's there. We'll now add the new budget that the board adopted. The next chapter is rulemaking authority and limitations. We've put in various sections from the state law to comply with that. As well as our, and then the next item, I'm sorry, is the audit. So once we get the final audit, we will update that. Laws, open meetings, public information, admin procedures, and conflicts. So under there, we have the handbooks from the Attorney General's Office on Public Information, open meetings laws, as well as a lot of the laws that you'll see, actually we reference throughout the meetings from the Texas Government Code, the 551, 552, 171, 176, those are there, and those get updated every time there's a change in the state law. It's an easy way for you to find them. And then other laws, Josh has gone through and kind of picked other laws that apply to the board and put them in this location.
We have Code of Ethics and Governance. You can find the ethics policy there as well as the government's conduct policy. To me, this is the hardest place to find it. They're also on our website if you ever need them, or you can contact us. And then the last item is training regarding risk and investing in alternative assets. So we have a presentation from Makita there. That is what's required in this training manual. We keep it updated. It's there for you anytime you want to. Any questions about that?
So does the acknowledgement have to be, like, do I or you? Because I would have to say, yes, I did as well. No?
Right, yeah. So Melissa has left each one of you one of these little items, and it acknowledges that we have a training manual, you know what's in it, you have access to it, and that you have the ethics policy, and we just need you to sign these things on an annual basis.
Yeah.
So that's all we need there. We don't need a motion or anything.
There's no motion. You can just make sure you sign as before you leave.
Is there a continuing education like what we need to have? Or?
On this, no, but I do. I can have Sasha send you that. Or I can see if I have that email. I'll have her send everybody what their updated education rules are. The PRB has changed some of their training requirements, so we'll be sending you that as well.
Okay. I think the next items are going to be in closed session. So,
did you want to talk about anything under Prop U?
Well, we can talk about briefly in open session about Prop U, and then we'll talk a little bit in closed session. So I sent the email out earlier last week about Prop U passing that has got language in there which has language about requiring contribution amounts to the pension system that are in excess revenue amounts. I'll have some observations in closed session. Basically, in open session, I will tell you that what I heard yesterday is that the city met for 2.5 hours in its own executive session where the city attorney was trying to explain to the council what they thought some of these propositions meant, I think in particular Prop S and Prop U, maybe some of the others, but those are, you know, clearly ones that the city was unhappy about passing. It was a huge effort on STNU. And SMU still passed. So Kelly, you know, Kelly has asked, she has sent an email to Jack Ireland, asked what do you think the additional amount of funding, what was the email?
I asked how they were interpreting the impact of Prop U on the pension system.
Okay. And
I haven't gotten a response.
Okay. So, and that's not surprising. I don't know that we will know, or I don't know how, when we'll know what the impact is. I don't know how we can analyze it precisely, because it requires to know what the city's interpretation of the language is. And, you know, obviously they met in closed session and they may continue to meet in closed session, so who knows what that interpretation is going to be. So I don't think our plan is to budget any additional money because of the Prop U passing at this point. It's the open session commentary I think we have on it for now.
For lack of a better word, it's uncharted territory. I mean, No one knows what it's going to mean. Okay, so I guess we're going into closed session.